high atop the skyline of downtown Chicago to 38 states and Canada. Your host for this evening, Justin Kaufman.
Tonight, you thought the coronavirus pandemic was dying down? Think again. Are you more worried today than you were 2 weeks ago? Also, if you're asking Jussie Smollett to pay for his investigation, should we ask former police superintendent Eddie Johnson to do the same? A Chicago columnist thinks so. And Facebook community groups, there to create community, but are they actually destroying it? Now, you definitely have thoughts on this one. And later in the show, a cashierless 7-Eleven launched in Dallas today. Is this the beginning or the end of modern day retail? Hello, everybody. It's Justin Kaufman. It's 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. I'm with you till 11 o'clock. We start tonight with our big story. While the president was speaking at the White House today, the DNC chair, Tom Perez, tweeted out that enough was enough and suggested that when it came to Iowa, it was time for a do-over. He called for a hand audit of the papers used in the almost 1,700 precincts in the state. This on the heels of Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg, both claiming victory in the botched Iowa caucuses, while the AP says they just can't call a winner. Wow. Are we witnessing the end of the Iowa caucuses? And if this holds true, should Illinois be in line to be the first primary in 2024? Tom Serafin's a longtime political strategist and CEO of Serafin & Associates and an actor on the side. We'll get to that in just a moment. Tom, I got to ask the question to start. Is the do-over the right thing to do for Iowa?
It is. I mean, unfortunately, they really face a lot of problems right now. And so, unfortunately, you know, this is a very dark spot for them. And it also is a reflection on the national party. And as you heard tonight, the national party is disagreeing with the local party in Iowa. And when that happens, that's bad. I mean, that's bad for everybody. And all these candidates, and they spent so much money and so much time. And, you know, I've been there myself, you know, with a couple of different candidates. Mm-hmm. It's heartbreaking when you lose, but it's heartbreaking when you can't get anybody to tell you who won.
Yeah. Why not move forward? Why not say, you know what, to scratch Iowa, it's bad for publicity, it's bad for the party, it's bad for voters. Why not just say, scratch it, it was a tie, New Hampshire?
I agree with you, but at this point in time, this is going to be a very difficult race between now and November. So those kinds of decisions and those executive decisions should be made after the general election. Right now, Iowa should not be in a position where it could go either way, but it looks like it might be leaning in one direction more than another direction, and the Democrats need to win Iowa. I mean, we're not talking about a lot of votes, but we're talking about a state and electoral college that might be very close. So, you know, they need to appeal to those voters, and they don't want to alienate them, but they do want to make sure that they get it right. And unfortunately, you know, we listen to those Twitter feeds, and it's a conspiracy against, you know, Bernie, and like it was, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. And those kinds of things kind of have legs if you don't address them. So those are the issues you need to address. You kind of, you can put Iowa on the shelf as an example, but you really don't want to go after them right now because you need them in your camp. But you have to deal with the Bernie part of the electorate, because that's what cost Hillary the election last time. You know, there were 75,000 Democrats in Michigan that voted in the election but avoided the election of the president, did not cast a ballot, and she lost that state by about 20,000 votes. Wow. Those are Bernie voters.
Yeah. Tom Serafin's my guest, of course, a longtime great political strategist in Chicago, a CEO of Serafin & Associates, and like I said, an actor on the side, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But I want to get into that.
I go hand in hand.
Yeah, I saw that in Shia's column today. But, you know, as we think about what it means to recount votes, especially in a caucus, does everyone have to get back together, or are they just going through a hand audit of what already took place?
They have to go through a hand audit of everything that took place. The one thing that the party has been reassuring everyone in all the various different campaigns and with the media is that they have paper backup, and the paper backup will need to be addressed. But the problem is that, you know, this is the first time they actually talked about all the votes that went on in all the various different caucuses. They've always kept a lot of that information privileged. So paper backup might mean something to the people in Iowa, but when you're counting the votes, and you're from the Democratic National Committee, or you're from Bernie's campaign, or the Mayor of South Bend's campaign, you're going to want to make sure that those votes are accurate, they were accurately cast, and they were legitimate ballots that took place on that particular evening. There's so much that could go wrong and has gone wrong for it to go right at this point with the contentious nature of the campaign as we squeeze this primary season now. It's underway. You have everybody being very competitive, and now you have Iowa saying, well, maybe we, and then somebody else. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to come out of there with any legitimacy at this point. And I think the harder you go after it, it reminds me of the impeachment battle. Everybody knew the outcome in the Senate, but they pursued it with all their vigor and ignored everything else. And if the Democrats do that with Iowa, they're making the same mistake inside their own house.
Okay, so let's talk about 2024. You saw the governor of the state of Illinois say, hey, you know what? The Iowa caucus is bad for everybody. Why don't we start with Illinois next time around? The Tribune in an op-ed today said that's a bad idea. Mark Brown in the Sun-Times said it's too cold in February. What do you make of the fact that that Illinois is lining up to want to be the first primary stop in 2024?
Well, you know, it's a good way to get some attention. I think $30 million or more, you know, the money it spent in Iowa, it was enormous. I think it was $300 million. I mean, it was just ridiculous, the number of dollars spent there. Those dollars obviously would be spent here, and they would be spent on, you know, network television stations, WGN, WMA, all these stations in town and throughout the state. But, you know, the unfortunate nature is that it would draw attention to Illinois, and people would have to deal with the problems of Illinois at the time. And that might not be that might be a good outcome because, you know, unfortunately, we just don't pay attention to the serious issues and what's indigenously wrong here in Illinois. And that would really bring the spotlight on it. And maybe the governor has an idea here that that might help him move the needle when it comes to ethics, corruption, and dealing with the broken economy of this state. It's terrible.
Now, some have said, and I've heard this, that Illinois as a state, when it comes to both parties, it's more indicative of what America is like. You've got a big city, you've got a heartland, you've got a lot of variety and diversity when it comes to voters, much more than the state of Iowa. So it would actually be a great starting point for a presidential run on both sides of the aisle. Do you agree with that, the idea that we're more representative of what America is like in 2020, 2024?
I don't think we're well represented, you know, based on the numbers. We unfortunately, I mean, we are a Democratic state, a blue state, and will be, you know, for the rest of my lifetime. But, you know, we lost 240,000 African-American folks, you know, in the last 10 years. This new census is going to show us that we're going to probably have to, you know, change the structure inside the city council and in the legislature and lose a congressional seat. Downstate, there's more poverty per capita than there is up here. Healthcare is bad. You can't get an ambulance to take you from a farm to a hospital 45 minutes away. It's no jobs. I mean, the towns are, you know, empty. The kids aren't staying home. They have all kinds of issues, and that's why if Chicago has problems in Springfield, they're going to have to understand they're going to have to give something to the people that live south of 74, and there's no deal there yet, and the governor's got to make something work so that the mayor has some options to help her out here in the city of Chicago. So I don't think we're like everybody else because we have so many of these other issues, and we're dominated by a veto-proof majority of Democrats in Springfield, in the legislature, in the city council, everywhere you look.
Yeah. Political strategist.
I mean, we did spot 100 Republicans in Rockford, but they were heading towards Freeport in the other direction.
Tom Serafin is a political strategist. Also, okay, so before I let you go, let's talk about this unnecessary farce, which you're doing at the Morton College in Cicero. Yeah. Where does this come from? I didn't know at all that you were an actor.
Well, I've been doing this for, you know, about 7-8 years, and I got into it. My sons were actors in school and college, and they kind of talked me into it. We're performing at the Jed Lithico Performing Arts Center, and they are, you know, a semi-professional theater, and they're trying to get their theater back up on the ground. And David Nez, who is a terrific comedy director in Chicago and has been for a very long time, actually produced the play called Unnecessary Farce about 7 years ago at the Western Springs Community Theater, which is the oldest one in the country, 97 years. They do wonderful performances over and over again. I've been on that stage a few times and really, really enjoyed it. And David, they asked him if they would be part of this revitalization program. He said, of course I will. And he said, can you do unnecessary farce? And David said, hey, I did that place 7 years ago. So he called some of the old cast. Tammy White is here. Laura Leonardo Ombi is here. Tim Feeney is the mayor. Eileen and Tim Casey are great Chicago actors, have been all over town. Scott Hayes has been doing this thing for a long time. And I, you know, I'm kind of a virgin at the game because I started late in life. But, you know, Cassie Dawes is the producer. And, you know, we got a beautiful theater here, seats about 300 folks. And we've been in rehearsals since, you know, the end of Christmas. And it's a lot of fun. And, you know, the irony is the plot line, it's about corruption in a city. And I play the Don Knotts type cop that stumbles into it all. And Tammy plays a cop, and Eric plays a cop. I mean, they're all part of the structure. And eventually, good wins out over evil. But, you know, there's eight doors we're going in and out of. You're going to laugh your fanny off. It's a very, very funny play.
Tom,
play.
What about your life as a strategist and being in politics your entire life? How does it prepare you to be on the stage?
Oh, you know, it gives you a lot of confidence because, you know, when you're out there, I was just talking to somebody referred to me at a speech I gave a couple weeks ago as a political scientist. And, you know, I was in Paul Simon's public affairs reporting program. I was a reporter for 10 years before I got into this business. And, you know, I have my master's, but I'm not a scientist. I never thought of myself that way. But as you see these things and predict them along the way, you're startled by the repetition. And as I grow older, I don't know if I'm getting smarter or I'm getting more disappointed, because I think the game of politics is played now by the people at a much lesser level than we used to play it in the old days. And I remember when Dave Axelrod was a reporter at the Tribune who covered my campaigns. You know, it's more a little bit more sophomore and more predictable. I'm kind of disappointed that this game, you know, everybody's gotten into it, everybody's got an opinion, but to make a difference, you really have to be motivated by some better good for everybody. Yeah. And you have to show that you can actually put it into place, which is disappointing, you know, because you don't see that follow through now in the business. It's there, it's possible. Young people are doing it. My son Matt is involved in politics, and he's very much on the sides of the progressives. But the kids are actually talking about it and doing it. We need to encourage more of it. One of the proudest moments, you know, in the last 4 years, I worked on legislation in Springfield. It took us a long time, but it requires, the legislation was passed and it's now law. It requires every graduating senior in Chicago's Illinois schools to have at least one semester of civics.
Just,
you know,
one.
We grew up with civics.
Right.
One, but you have to teach these. Yeah, I know, Jeff. You have to teach these kids over and over again. It's like playing. You know, I used to coach the women's softball team, you know, CBS in the old days, and all these anchors and all these professional producers used to come out there. But you have to teach them, you know, how to catch a big ball like that and not jam your fingers. You have to be able to do all these things that are necessary in order to be able to play the game. And people jump into the game now without understanding how difficult it is.
Yeah,
to
that.
Move policy and legislation and issues. So all of that is, you know, critically involved. I wish I could spend more time with young people because they've got the energy and the heart for it. And, you know, as we get older, unfortunately, I don't know what the problem is. People are leaving Illinois because of the economy, but they shouldn't be leaving. They should be willing to stick in and fight. We're very close to turning this state around from a policy and a good government point of view. We're really, really, really close. There's a generational change going on, and a lot of people have given up and have moved, but we're really close, and I would like to see, you know, we've lost a lot of good minds. I'd like to see us stick around a little bit longer.
Well, political strategist Tom Serafin, who joins us tonight, Unnecessary Farces at the Morton College in Cicero at the Jedlicka Performing Center,
right,
3801 Central in Cicero.
Right.
Joins us tonight.
Right off of I-55 and Central, and we're here Saturday night, 8 o'clock, Sunday matinee, and then next Friday and Saturday at 8 p.m., and then the following Sunday at 2. Come on out. The tickets are really inexpensive. A senior, $10, $15 general admission, and you're going to laugh for 2 hours, and you're going to go home happy.
There you go.
One
Thanks,
better
Tom.
Day.
Thanks for joining us.
God
I
bless
appreciate
you.
It.
Take care, Justin.
Okay.
Thank you.
Justin Kaufman with the 720 WGN with till 11 o'clock tonight, 312-981-7200. Great to hear about Tom's double life, both as a political strategist and an actor. But, you know, he brought up some really great points. And that's what I want to talk about in this hour, 312-981-7200. Should Illinois treat the primary season in 2024 like trying to get a convention to town. Now that there's so many troubles with the Iowa caucuses and across the country, we've decided that this is not the right system and Iowa probably shouldn't be going first. Why shouldn't we treat it like the Olympic bid? Or trying to get at, in the fact Tom mentioned that, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars are spent by candidates on our airwaves, in our restaurants, in our industries. And the fact that there would have to be at least some recognizing of political corruption and some of the things that dog Illinois, and then have to clean that up before people come to town, just like they do in the Olympics. You have the Olympics in a certain town, they like to sweep the crime to a certain corner of town until the Olympics are over. We'd have to do the same thing with political corruption. So what do you think? I think Illinois definitely should bid for that. I think Governor Pritzker's right. 312-981-7200. I know the Trib today had an op-ed saying it was a bad idea and that Illinois is not the right state with all of our troubles to be leading off a presidential election. But I say hogwash to that. I say we should. I wonder a lot. I just think at the end of the day, we're in a great position to get a little influx of cash. Think about all the money they'd be spending, not just in Chicago. We're doing downstate, the Peoria, out western, out northern, everywhere. They would be dropping money to try and get your vote. You know how long they spent in Iowa? How many times we had to see Joe Biden trying to wrestle an Iowan? He'd be trying to wrestle Illinoisans. I don't think there's a downside to it. And I want to hear from you. I just want to talk about whether or not we should host, be the kickoff, the primary that brings the presidential elections online 2024. Iowa can't handle it. They made it clear. I think we can. I think it'd be a great moment for us. And maybe, you know, as Tom said, maybe we can handle it. Maybe we have bigger issues. And obviously, there'd be a big, huge flashlight on the state of Illinois, especially with everybody leaving town or leaving the state. But I think it's a great opportunity for us. Millions and millions of dollars just pumped into the local economies. We have not been talking about that. That's one thing about the Tribune op-ed today. And the op-ed essentially pointed out all the things that were flawed with the state of Illinois and how we're losing population and that this would not be indicative of the city and of the United States of America. That we might actually move the election in a different direction than it should. That's the idea of being in the heartland in Iowa. But I think the argument should be, or truly I want to hear from you on this. I think the argument should be this is a opportunity for an influx of cash. I don't know why this isn't being compared to the Olympic bids and other places. It is a big deal to launch an election campaign. Every single one of the candidates, it doesn't matter if it's Republican or Democrat, spend a lot of time on the ground in the state that kicks it off. Right now, we're March 17th. We're not hearing anything. The state of Illinois is not in play. There's not Bernie Sanders people out on Michigan Avenue. There's not Pete Buttigieg ads all over WGN radio. They're not interested in the state. We're not at all relevant. And because of that, we're losing money. Money that's on the table for the taking. So regardless of all the little things that might stop an opportunity like this, I think we go for it. I'm with the governor. I think the governor should push harder for this. I think he should get the mayor on board. I think every single booster, Ken Griffin, Oprah, Scottie Pippen, get the whole team together like it's an Olympic bid. That's what I would like to see. 312-981-7200. Let's get a pep squad going for the state of Illinois to kick off the elections in 2020. Coming up, let's talk coronavirus. We'll also, in the 8 o'clock hour, I want to talk about Facebook groups. This is, you know, the idea that you maybe belong to a Facebook group that is really the replacement of the local newspaper. Maybe it's your neighborhood, maybe it's a community, maybe it's a town, maybe it's a city, whatever it might be. But you know as much as I, those were created to foster community. But in the end, they're dividing us. Political conversations take over, rudeness, an incivility among our peers and neighbors It seems to be doing the exact opposite that it was supposed to do. Do you agree with me? 312-981-7200. It's Justin Kaufman. It's 720 WGN. Stay with us. 312 says New Hampshire has a state law that requires it to be the first primary in the nation. It's been the first since 1920 by tradition. That's why Iowa does not hold a primary. They caucus. So? What does that have to do with Illinois? 312-981-7200. Asking you the question of whether or not we should make a play to be the first in the nation when it comes to primaries or caucuses, whatever you want to call it, in 2024. Because it's a simple way to get around that. Just don't call it a primary. Call it a challenge. Or maybe a championship. Cage match. It would work out really well. You just don't call it a primary. You'll be fine. But yeah, right now, of course, with the Iowa caucuses, a hot mess. It's like an opportunity for Illinois to jump in and grab what essentially, as Tom Serafin said, is akin to convention money. It's like getting the All-Star game here or Lollapalooza. We've heard so many arguments about whether or not those places, those events should be in Chicago, and so many pro arguments, right? It's a whole concept. We put a bid in for the Olympics. I believe we should be putting a bid in for the number one primary challenge, championship, cage match, whatever you want to call it, in 2024. 815 says, I'm not sure Illinois could get it right. Now, that's true. I have to say, that may be a good point. Something we haven't been thinking about is that we'd get that, but then we would have the Illinois Democratic Party running the show, or the Republican Party. But let's just say if it was this year, 2020, it'd be the Illinois Democratic Party, which is run by Mike Madigan. They would be in charge of the primary, which they are now, and both parties are anyway. And Illinois hasn't had a bad track record when it comes to elections. There were a couple of times, I believe, in Cook County where some machines went haywire. Maybe in city elections, but there's never really been any widespread outages. The advent of the computerized or digital ballot caused a ton of trouble. Remember, I think it was the Cook County president's race between Todd Stroger and Tony Perica. Remember when Perica went and he stormed the office and he had a protest down LaSalle Street or whatever street that was? That was a couple years ago, 10 years ago. I think that was over voting irregularities and some voting machines that weren't working, things like that, reporting it. But overall, I don't think we've had statewide issues at all. I think we'd be totally prepared for something like that. 312 says it just means New Hampshire will always move their primary earlier, no matter what date another state chooses. So choose January 1st. Can't do it any earlier than that.
Well, we'll do January 1st at 2:30. And you're at 3, we're at 2:30.
I don't know. I feel with all of the lawyers, we need to get Rich Lenkov on the line. For all the lawyers that are available when it comes to political campaigns and politics in this day and age, whether it's just lawsuits against other parties over policy and procedures, I feel like that one easily could be lawyered up. Oh, it's on the state books for New Hampshire? Oh, I don't know if we can. That's ironclad. I don't know what we can do now. New Hampshire, oh, they have it in their state constitution. We can't do anything about it. Oh, we might as well just, nope. Wrap up. 847 says, how about we take over and we get ranked choice voting? There you go. Maybe that's not a primary. It's a ranked choice experience. Regardless, just think of all the hotel rooms. Think of all the printmakers in town that would be getting some action from all the Buttigieg signs and the Klobuchar t-shirts. Not to mention, Klobuchar would be here with her hot dishes. All the tater tots we can eat. So many options for the state of Illinois. And I truly, it's funny because the editorial that the Tribune put out today was very strange in really going against what we could offer, Chicago and Illinois. One of the things that was mentioned in this op-ed was the idea that we would pick a candidate that may not be right for America. And they referenced this year in 2020 that in Chicago and the state of Illinois, because we're a blue state And we have a diverse voter electorate here in Chicago. You may see a Kamala Harris, or a Cory Booker, essentially a candidate of color. Okay. That's such a bad thing. Where in Iowa, I think, you know, you get your true blue, which, again, I'm a little bit concerned what that rhetoric is. If Kamala Harris is dropping out of the race because she can't sustain a campaign across the United States of America because she can't win in Iowa, then maybe it's stacked against her. Maybe she'll change, and maybe a good candidate of color will come out of the Illinois primary and we'll have more choices than when you look at the final four that are standing now. You go, well, this seems like it's all dudes, all white dudes. That's what it's going to be. 312-981-7200. Get some good texts on this. I found it amazing Monday night when the vote tolls came in Iowa that all the candidates that put climate change at the top of their agenda hightailed it out of town on their private jets. There was a great Onion article that showed a Biden bus and a Klobuchar bus, and it said something to the effect of they ran over 150 Iowans racing to get out of town. That doesn't make sense. 309 says, we're much more diverse than Iowa or New Hampshire. I agree. That's why I think this would be a perfect place for it. America's diverse. The primary system in general and what's happening right now is that you are putting so much emphasis on what one state, which I would believe, and I like the state of Iowa, but it's not the most diverse state in the union. You're going for a very kind of heartland vibe, and then you roll right into a erudite northeastern vibe. You know, the first two, I don't know, I feel like it's fool's gold. Not until we start getting to some of the states that are more representative of the America we live in, Republican or Democrat. I think that's a problem. I think Illinois would be that. You have downstate farm agriculture's big here. You have Chicago, which of course is diverse and big city and liberal, but also the center of transportation, the center of industry. You have an amazing suburban collar county Republican establishment that would gladly be home for, I'm sure, DuPage County would go crazy to have a Republican primary that they get to kick off in 2024. You've got a great political city in Springfield, Illinois. And you've got very diverse industries and interests when you go south. I think it's a great spot for all the candidates to be able to talk to Americans of every stripe. If you're a Democrat, you're going to have to deal with Democrats downstate that have a different set of principles than a Democrat that's living in the Gold Coast. 312-981-7200 is our phone number tonight. Justin Kaufman with you here on 720 WGN till 11 o'clock. We got lots to talk about tonight. We're going to have a fun show. Let's go to Aaron. Aaron, what do you think about the idea of Illinois kicking it off?
That'd be fine, but I mean, Iowa voted for the caucus for Obama in 2008. Mm-hmm. He came out of that, and it was a big surprise. So they didn't have any trouble picking a person of color.
Right. True. That's true. That's absolutely true. Thank you.
Yeah.
Very much
I mean,
for
we're
that
very
point.
Diverse, but I think if you have the right person, it doesn't really.
Doesn't matter.
Hopefully, people will pick the right person. Yeah.
That's a good point, and that's what I would argue with the Tribune op-ed. That I felt it was very short-sighted is a softball term. Short-sighted to think just because Chicago has a diverse population that you may pick a diverse candidate that may not be right for America. I don't buy that. It just feels, I don't know. 309 says the only downfall would be the ads. I agree. There'd be tons of ads. There'd be so many ads. But, you know, let's think about who's getting the money from those ads. The television industry, the radio industry, the billboards. That money is being put back into our communities. Maybe not all communities, but at least it means they're spending it here and not somewhere else. How about get rid of the delegates and do a straight-up popular vote, says Dave. Open a two-week window at the end of February. Each state can pick any day they want within that window to hold their primary. If you want your state to be an influencer, you pick an early date. If you want your state to possibly be a decider, you pick a late date. Oh, I love that idea. That's a great idea. Dave, coming through. Thank you, Dave. It's almost like a challenge. It's a two-week challenge. Not unlike a Game 7 series in baseball or basketball or hockey. I love that idea. That's a strong idea. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break here. Maybe we'll leave it at Dave's comments here, and we'll move on to coronavirus. There's some new stats out today and some trouble from a Taiwanese newspaper that seemed to be giving different stats than everybody else. We'll talk about that. Coming up here, Justin Kaufman, 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here, 720 WGN, with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Well, you know, it's now been 2 weeks since we were introduced to the coronavirus. And last week we were talking about the number of cases being around 1,000. Remember that? That was just a week ago. It had jumped from 600 to 1,100. We did a whole segment on this show. Well, whoa, that's almost double. Well, today the number of cases across the globe are now over 28,000. So to give you an idea, in a week's time, how it went from 1,100 to 28,000. And deaths, they're up over 550 right now. Researchers believe, with cases still under investigation, that it's actually closer to 75,000 people who have been infected in China. And still, some are still concerned that the numbers coming out of China are controlled by the government, and they're much lower than reported. The doctor who first discovered the virus, you saw that today, he was detained for alerting people. Remember this? And this is how the Chinese government works. He was letting people know that there was this respiratory virus that was new. Something's wrong. And they detained him because they didn't want him spreading that information. Well, the doctor died. That's straight out of a World War Z film, right? The first doctor who saw it is dead. In the U.S., we're still seeing relatively low numbers, but that hasn't stopped us from scooping up every single mask off store shelves. Some say it's going to be months till those masks will be restocked. It's affecting so many parts of our daily lives. Special occasions, a couple live streamed their wedding over fears of the virus. And the Zoom video conferencing site, you know that app that you use? It's a video conferencing app. Its stock has gone sky high, more than 10%, as more companies are teleconferencing their weekly meetings to avoid face-to-face contact. And many scientists are pointing out that this is a respiratory virus. And respiratory viruses recur year after year. So get used to the word coronavirus. Because not unlike the flu, it's going to be coming back every single year. But with all that being said, as John Williams talked to it today on his show, these numbers are still a far cry from the flu. So far, this season alone, 10,000 people have died from the flu. 180,000 people have been hospitalized this flu season alone, according to the CDC. 180,000 people. Now, that being said, there's a paper out of Taiwan that's reporting on a site that is doing a tracker. A Chinese site that's doing a tracker. And on the site, their numbers are always way higher. More like what I just quoted. 180,000 people who've been hospitalized. 25,000 dead. And then, as they put it out, the numbers changed. And now they're in line and they're identical to what the Chinese government is reporting. Now, it could be a glitch. Could be fake. Who knows? But it's happened more than once, and people paying attention, especially in Taiwan, because in China they lock down the internet. But in Taiwan, they're paying attention to this, and they think it's a glitch that the tracker actually knows how many people are sick, and the government is covering it up. That's all alleged. No truth to that I can report. But it does make you think, as we've talked about in this program, are we getting the full scope especially as numbers go from 1,100 to 28,000 in a week. Are those real? So where are we 2 weeks later? Are you changing your habits? Are you changing your life because of this virus, the coronavirus? Are you concerned about what's happening on the other side of the world and how it's going to get here? 312-981-7200. Some people might have called in or texted in last time saying, I don't care. This is not going to affect me. And now you recognize that, like me, I'm avoiding touching doors. I am not a germaphobe. But I have found myself doing the shoulder elbow push on every public door that I run into in any circumstance. We went to Water Tower over the weekend, and it was on my mind. It was on my mind because there was a group of people. I know it's not here in Chicago, or limited here in Chicago, but I found myself being very careful on what I touched, who I stood by, things like that. Anyone coughing? I'm out of there. 312-981-7200. And are we prepared for this to just be part of our daily lives? I mean, our yearly lives. It's going to be back every winter. There are going to be signs on the Walgreens and the CVS and the Target saying, here, get your coronavirus vaccine here. It's going to be not unlike the way we approach the flu. These numbers may become normalized. Oh, 180,000 people in the hospital? Okay. But to hear those numbers, to see that 180,000 people so far in a flu season, one flu season, starting from what, November to now? That's what a flu season usually is, when it gets cold. And hospitals can handle 180,000 people coming through. They can. We never hear the story. We're going to get the story that, ooh, the flu season's bad this year. But we don't get the kind of stories we have now where Tamiflu is off the shelf, or masks are off the shelf, or hospitals can't catch up, or we got to build a new hospital for all these flu victims. That's 180,000. Now, I'm not a researcher or a scientist, but I would also assume that China has the flu, and I would assume that they are prepared for the same kind of numbers that the CDC is reporting. So when you see storylines of hospitals being built in 6 days or whatever, how long it took, and all sorts of extra precautions being made because they weren't prepared for a virus like this, it makes you question the numbers, because the numbers are much lower than any sort of influenza outbreak. Now, that being said, the U.S., you can only assume, I assume, in the Center for Disease Control, they're on the up and up, right? They're telling us the truth. They're not hiding. They're not state-run. They are state-run, but they're not hiding anything. If they had outbreak numbers, they would tell you. That's part of the, I would think, the protocol there. And that being said, the numbers are relatively, if not infinitively lower. Think about it. Think about how low the numbers are here. To think that 180,000 people are infected or hospitalized, that's not even talking about how many people actually get the flu. You would just think that we would be in much more of a panic, meaning you'd have sold out masks and things if the numbers were that high. But they're not. The numbers are less than 100. Are there any confirmed deaths in America? Is there anybody outside who actually was not in the Chinese province that hasn't just been treated? I mean, even the two people in Chicago, the woman and her husband, they're stable and improving. Not unlike having the flu. So who to believe? 312-981-7200. Coronavirus is, of course, here to stay, and we'll continue to talk about and cover it. I'm just blown away that people have decided that they're going to do a live stream of their wedding for fears of being exposed to the coronavirus. That blows my mind. And it doesn't, I guess it makes a lot of sense too that, you know, if you work at a big company and you don't want to have close face-to-face contact, that you're going to go into using some of the technology that's going to provide you to not have to be face-to-face, like the Zoom conference. So that does make sense as well. But I'm interested to see what happens if at a next point in the next week we get, oh, you know what? We forgot to round the one, right? You know what? We forgot that we didn't include the people in central Wuhan. And those numbers are going to go much higher. And I think at the end of the day, we're going to go, oh, they are just like the flu. And the arguments made to, oh, these are relatively low numbers will be removed. Something to pay attention to, and we will pay attention to it here on 720 WGN. All right, coming up, let's talk about former Superintendent Eddie Johnson and whether or not he should have to pay for his investigation, just like he asked Jussie Smollett to do, is trying to force him to do. It's an interesting article. Mark Conkle is going to join us at 8 o'clock. Stay with us. 720 WGN, I'm Justin Kaufman, 312-981-7200. I'm with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Well, last hour we talked about whether or not Illinois should kick off the primary season in 2024. And coming up next, I'm going to talk about the Facebook community groups created to foster community, but are they actually destroying it? That's a topic coming up at 8:30, 312-981-7200. But first, it's been almost a year since former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel and former Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson stood up and demanded that actor Jussie Smollett pay for his police investigation. This after it was alleged that he faked his attack. Fast forward a couple months and the superintendent himself was investigated after a traffic stop and after being accused of lying to the mayor, was removed from office. So should the same logic apply to the superintendent that they applied to Jussie Smollett? Well, that's the premise of Chicago columnist Mark Conkle's latest in Patch, and he joins me now. Mark, should the former superintendent be on the hook for his own investigation?
I mean, it's a pretty good idea, don't you think?
I think it's a great idea, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what's good for the goose? But I think the big thing here is, like, you know, Chicago should win this lawsuit against Jussie Smollett, right? I mean, he probably should pay for it, but his lawyers are seeming to argue with the subpoena that will probably get quashed and probably never get entered in the federal court, that it's malicious for them not to do it to someone like, say, the top cop who lied about what happened to him and the situation that it involved when he got caught asleep behind the wheel after having drinks out late one night with a woman that wasn't his wife but happened to work for him, allegedly. So, you know, I think that one of the things we're talking about, it's not about Eddie Johnson and it's not about Jussie Smollett. It's about Rule 14, which is something that I've been writing about since, you know, 2013. And that's a rule in the Chicago Police Misconduct Code that says if you lie, you give a false written or oral report, that you should be fired.
Right.
And when it comes down to trust in the Chicago Police Department, it's the lies that are the biggest problem. And don't just take it from me. That's what the U.S. Justice Department said in its report that said that Chicago Police Department is a big hall of corruption for generations.
Yeah, I wonder about that because the law department at the city of Chicago seems to... They should be on the hook for, but they'll defend, and they have stopped investigations into these kind of things, especially when police officers are involved with lies. So why are they doing that? Why are they doing it on behalf of taxpayers to protect police officers when there is a law on the books that is a very, very obvious law that says if you do it, you'll be fired?
It's that double standard. It's the fact that the city is on the hook for the civil lawsuit because a police officer is an employee. And so what they do is defend them because of the money that's involved. Mm. And what that does is it harbors the culture of corruption. Yeah. And when it comes to what Eddie Johnson did was allegedly bald-faced lie to the mayor about what happened and get fired. And now there's lawyers in court trying to squash a subpoena that Jussie Smollett's lawyers want out there to protect his reputation. And it's a double-edged sword. First of all, you know, when Rahm filed this lawsuit, you know, it was a pound of flesh. It was almost a publicity stunt where he was pounding his chest and saying, no one should demean the reputation of Chicago. And but when it comes to the, you know, the police superintendent, you know, the, right. the long-standing reputation Chicago has for, you know, cops who lie to cover up for other cops, like, I don't know, that's a pretty bad reputation.
I agree. I wonder, Mark, you know, when you think about this story and you see what, you know, what the mayor wanted, what the superintendent wanted, they wanted to essentially make the person who falsified the report pay for the investigation.
Right.
You wonder about what precedent that sets, if every person who does that is going to be on the hook, and maybe they should be. The idea of privatizing these investigations. If you lie, if you falsify your records, you're paying for it. You're not only going to be slapped with an arrest, but you're also going to get a bill at the end of the day. I don't know if that's a problematic thing. I think that may be a good thing.
Well, there's that, but then it turns around to the point where, are you punishing a poor person who lies to the cops?
Right.
You know, I mean, if you take away Jussie Smollett, what he did, and you take away, you just look at him as like a rich person who lied to the cops, and you look at Eddie Johnson, who is a person in a place of public trust, who lied to the mayor, who lied to the police as well, you know, who lied to the public in press conferences, who brought his family up as a human shield when he had his fake retirement press conference, you know. That's a lot of steps to take to cover up something that should be public knowledge, and we're spending a lot of money with the Inspector General investigating this. We're spending a lot of money going after $130,000 investigation of the Jussie Smollett case, and for what? Shouldn't this be Kim Fox's problem? I mean, why is this a city problem?
Yeah,
you know, the cops found out that it was fake, allegedly, and she dropped the case, and this should be her problem, but it's hurting taxpayers even more from all different parts of your tax bill.
Do you think that anyone has the political will or idea, or if I think of the mayor now, or maybe someone in city council would pick this up and read what you're writing and say, yeah, absolutely. Why are we spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on an inspector general's report on a former police superintendent when we know what happened? And at the end of the day, he lied to us. So shouldn't he be paying for it?
So, I mean, somebody should. Right. I mean, they won't, because it could happen to them. You know, I mean, I don't think that there's, you know, a cadre of good do-gooders there. And I don't think that it's something that's on the top of the mayor's,
to-do list.
She got rid of him.
Right.
You know, the repercussions of this should be big, because ultimately the little thing that Eddie did was go out, have some drinks, and drive his own cop car home. You know, could have got him suspended, you know. All he had to do was tell the truth, and he tried to cover it up. Other people allegedly are involved in trying to cover it up for him. It's not police misconduct. It's not even something as serious as what happened to Laquan McDonald. It's everyday stuff. I wrote about this with Quinn Ford in 2014 when DNA Info was still around. It's about a cop who lies about throwing dog poop on his neighbor's porch, or flirting with twin girls at the Walgreens, or accidentally shooting off his pepper spray at a downtown steakhouse. Like, these are the lies that you shouldn't tell. You should just say, I made a mistake, take a punishment, and go on. But if you lie, you know, the saying around the country is for police, like, if you lie, you die. And that should be the standard, because we're putting a lot of trust. We're giving a lot of power. We're well arming police officers. We respect them to do their job, and most of them do their job. And it should just be the standard that, look, if you mess up, tell the truth, and you're going to get punished. You know, maybe you're going to lose 2 weeks' pay. Maybe you lose a month's pay. The guy at the Walgreens lied and lost 5 years' pay. Hmm. But he didn't get fired.
But I wonder, though, if there already is this culture around that, and you have a better shot if you don't trust your authorities, you don't trust your bosses, you don't trust the system, you don't trust the politicians, and your pepper spray goes off at a steakhouse, You may trust the fellow officers in covering it up as opposed to letting your fate be decided by the wind in which way it's blowing when it comes to politics and the top brass at the police department.
Well, I mean, of course. The misconduct, the system for punishing police misconduct in Chicago has been broken a long time. The problem with that is it's always been skewed for police. It's always been set up where there were methods in place to delay it for years and to get it squashed. And systems for the police superintendent's recommendation for termination to not be approved systematically. It has to go through the police board. The police union is involved. There are so many steps that were part of a cover-up, and the U.S. Justice Department says this.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and over and over again, you know, as a journalist and reading and a person who reads the news, you see police misconduct being written about as a single incident. I don't know how many people have made comments about my coverage of Eddie Johnson and said, like, look, all he did was have a couple of drinks. It's not that big a deal. Okay, sure, it's not that big a deal. But lying to everybody about it is a huge deal, especially in a place where you're out front publicly trying to quote unquote build trust in the police department. But it's, you know, I mean, the first time I interviewed Eddie Johnson, his wife was accused of cheating on a lieutenant's exam, and neither, regardless of that, I asked him, like, you know, if somebody lies, should they be fired? And he hemmed and hawed about it. Hmm. I mean, that's the culture. That's the problem. Why don't people trust the police?
Yeah. My last question for you: Jussie Smollett got a lot of, at least you know, in the press, the local press, everyone just kind of rolled their eyes at him trying to get at some of the mayor's correspondence or the mayor's papers when it comes to what happened with Eddie Johnson. But listening to your persuasive argument, if they get that, the idea being there's a double standard here. Why do the cops don't care here, but they want me to pay $130,000?
Well, I mean, it's not just the city's lawsuit against him anymore. He countersued them for malicious prosecution. That's what this is about now. Hmm. Like, I think the law department's in a pretty bad spot. You know, I mean, if they don't squat, they have to fight to squash this subpoena because it shouldn't be. I mean, it really shouldn't be an argument in the case against him, but in the counterclaim, it is an argument against him, and they don't want more evidence that shows that what could it be that a hothead mayor of Chicago who really liked to get the spotlight and was a lame duck wanted to draw attention to how tough he is on people by suing, you know, a disgraced actor for $130,000 that they spent investigating a false claim of a hate crime. I don't know. Could it be?
Yeah.
And that's what they're up against now. And I just think that it's one of those lawsuits that, where did it come from, and do we need it? And if we do need it, maybe somebody at the city council or the mayor's office, somebody at City Hall should suggest, like, Eddie Johnson embarrassed the mayor big time.
Yeah.
Put her on the spot big time. He validated the code of silence in his last days in office. So, I mean, should he be on the hook for that?
Yeah, right.
Should somebody else be on the hook for that?
Somebody
should.
Or should
my property taxes go up again?
Mark Gonkel is a Chicago columnist. You can find his stuff at patch.com/Illinois. Mark, thanks so much for joining me tonight. Appreciate it.
Always, Justin. Thanks. Love your show.
Justin Kaufman with you here at 720 WGN. Till 11 o'clock. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Mark's column brings up some really interesting points. I want to kind of delve into what we were just talking about. Because we're not trying to relitigate or go back into what happened with Eddie Johnson, the former superintendent, and everything that the mayor and the city and everyone has moved on from. But you saw the news last week when Jussie Smollett's lawyers sued, they want the correspondence between the mayor and the superintendent. And you're wondering why. Why would that have anything? What are you trying to do? What, you're just going to embarrass him because he tried to embarrass you? But when you listen to Mark's comments, there's something to be said
that there is a double standard, that the mayor didn't get up on stage and say, you're fired and I want the money from this inspector general's report that I'm working on, which is probably going to cost us $130,000. She didn't get up there and say, you broke a cardinal rule. You broke Rule 14. You lied. She didn't do any of that. She fired him and moved on. She said, lied to me. I don't like to be lied to. Okay. But when you think about how, and I'll say it, how dumb the lawsuit against Jussie Smollett was for us as taxpayers. Say whatever you want about the slimy dude that is Jussie Smollett. I don't have any love lost for the guy who made Chicago look pretty bad. He showed a lot of disdain for the city that was his home and dragged us all through it. But for the mayor of Chicago and Mayor Emanuel to get up there and thump his chest and do something that even all of us kind of scratched our head at, like, you can do that? You can sue somebody to recoup the money spent on detectives? You can do that? I'm in. Are we privatizing all of it? Are we going over everyone? Because this could be a money-making revenue stream for us. No longer do we have to, like Mark said at the end, jack up our property taxes or dip into the coffers or continue to defund. We have a way to fund all the pensions. Privatize these investigations. I didn't even know that was a thing. Well, it turns out it's not. And now, as you heard Mark say, and as much as you care, and I know you care about how much this debacle meant. You care that this actor came in and tried to make us look bad. But because of a macho mayor and I don't even know what you call Eddie Johnson's speech about integrity and you don't lie, and I think it's in Mark's piece what he said. He said Eddie Johnson got on the podium. You remember this? About a year ago. And he did an impassioned plea for Chicago. He was on with us on the Cochran Show, remember? Talking about impassioned plea for Chicago. He says, the accusations with this phony attack received national attention for weeks. Celebrities, news commentators, and even presidential candidates weighed in on something that was choreographed by an actor. And he went on to talk about he doesn't want to see his city be dragged through the mud like that. But at the end of the day, by moving forward on a lawsuit that was brought on by a mayor who wasn't running for re-election and a superintendent who ended up lying himself and was fired, we're on the hook as Jussie Smollett is countersuing us, the city of Chicago. And he probably will win. That it was malicious, that the lawsuit was malicious, that it was an overzealous approach, and it's unprecedented. And so what if he wins? And a judge goes, you're right, we looked at this evidence, and the mayor was wrong to bring this lawsuit to your attention. Here's $1.5 million because they ruined your career. Who's paying for that? Am I paying for that? Are you paying for that? That's what gets me angry. Is that the bravado of these politicians, one who got ran from the Atlantic because nobody wanted to work with him, the other who showed that he was willing to cover up to save his own ass. These two guys are going to put me on the hook? Could have walked away from that, man. And now we're sitting there listening to all the state's attorneys candidates who are running for mayor or running for state's attorney, talking about it, throwing it back in our face. Oh, you didn't do it right. Oh, Jussie Smollett. You can't escape it. Nobody's actually talking about the bigger issues, the issues about whether or not our criminal justice policies are working, whether or not our criminal justice system is effective in Cook County. Instead, it's all Jussie Smollett.
It's ridiculous. And it's all because, and I, that if they would have just stayed out of it, if they would have arrested him, gone to the state's attorney's office, the state's attorney drops it, you do your press conference, everybody gets mad, walks away from it. Sure, we could have all the conversations about how that went wrong and this, that, and the other. And, of course, nothing would have changed. Jussie Smollett would still not be working. He'd be out of Chicago. He would be disgraced. But instead, they misread the tea leaves. And the way that they're like, you know what? We got to do more than that. We got to be more than outraged. What if we sued him? What if we got our money back from him? And now here we are. And I'm just saying, hopefully everyone comes to their senses. Hopefully they drop a lawsuit, drop the countersuit. Everything moves on and we learned our lesson. But I don't know about you. 312-981-7200 if you want to get in on this. But I would be really disappointed if I had to pay out because Chicago did the wrong thing to this dude, this creepy dude. Just saying. I don't know if that would be the outcome we were all hoping for. And because of some overzealous politicians, and back to Mark Conkle's point, if this is the new world order, if we're now suing to recoup damages of investigations if you lie, pot calling kettle black, what? Then why are we not why are we not recouping the money from an investigation into the former superintendent? They're still investigating. They're still. So at the end of the day, does the superintendent, the former superintendent, get a bill? Oh, gosh, that'd be the worst case scenario, you guys. The worst. If at the end of the day, because of the missteps of a few politicians, Jussie Smollett gets to collect your money. I don't like it, man. And he wasn't even that good on Empire. I watched the show. He was the weakest link. Maybe the other brother. Everyone knows the middle child on Empire. He was the best. Nobody liked anybody else. All right, Rick's on the line. Rick, what do you think? What do you think? I mean, are you worried that Jussie Smollett's going to win this thing?
No, not even a little bit. I normally agree with you a lot, but tonight I feel like Jussie called the police and created an incident. The police commander, he just made a mistake, which triggered an investigation. You know what I'm trying to say? It's like, yeah. It's like apples and oranges. It's Jussie went out of his way to create this investigation, which cost us money.
Yeah.
And also, like, in terms of, like, the headlines nationwide, Jussie Smollett was like the Super Bowl. the police thing. His, Eddie Johnson, I keep forgetting his name, I'm sorry. His was like a preseason game. You know what I'm saying? Like, the differences of the scopes is pretty vast. You know what I'm saying? Like TMZ wasn't showing Eddie Johnson's drug, alleged drunk driving.
Right. I agree. Okay, Rick, I'll buy that. Thank you for the call, bud. Yeah, I don't know. I think that there's still a question because at the end of the day, they're looking into whether or not that was covered up, the Eddie Johnson thing. That's where the investments, maybe he made a mistake. No doubt he made a mistake. And that caused the pulling over. That caused everything that came after the fact. But there were a lot of opportunities, not unlike what Mark said in his piece and what he said tonight on the radio. There were a lot of opportunities for him to just go, yeah, I made a mistake. And instead, they went into, nah, what about this lie? Or what about this cover-up? Well, what if we just said this happened and that? They did everything they possibly could to not tell the truth. Now, I agree. When you're talking about national, what's more important? Obviously, Jussie Smollett is the Super Bowl and Eddie Johnson's a preseason game. I would say like a Week 7 game. You know, not a conference game, like maybe what AFC team, like you got to play the Raiders or something like that. The Raiders in London. Didn't he go to that game? 312-981-7200. All right, let's move on. Nobody wants to deal with Jussie Smollett. Get rid of that. They throw the paper across the room. Continues to be a thorn in our side.
All right, let's talk about Facebook community groups. This is this happened to you? You move into a new community, or you just want to learn more about the community you live in. You can't find any newspapers because they're all gone. There's no such thing anymore. So you go to Facebook or Nextdoor, and you search out the name of your town. Voila! You're connected with your neighbors. But instead of learning about the new business or even, I don't know, parking restrictions, you're treated to a robust argument about politics. This is happening all over Facebook. And what was originally the greatest idea to bring us all together, the Facebook community group has been hijacked. And it's bringing us the worst of our neighbors, the worst of humanity. 312-981-7200. Do you belong to your town or neighborhood Facebook page or next door page? Have you left your town's neighborhood Facebook or next door page? For instance, I don't know, the page has become almost the go-to for crime alerts. Right? You know what I'm talking about here. So there's going to be a Sun-Times or Tribune article, and someone's going to go to the Facebook page, and they're going to put up, did you see this? Well, you get the latest on a carjacking or burglary or maybe some other unsavory news. Does that mean that your community's in decline? Or has technology found a way to give us information on petty crime that we didn't have before? So now every time that somebody does something unsavory or criminal, it's like a referendum on your town or your neighborhood or your community or your politics, anything. And it devolves in the quickest way. For example, if you just relied on your neighborhood page, your community page, you would think that the whole city was taken over by thieves, phone snatchers, carjackers, bag stealers. See, stole all those Gucci bags. But if you look at the overall crime numbers that were just put out citywide in January, petty crime is actually down 3%. You would never know that. Which is it? 312-981-7200. Let's get into it. All right. It's funny. Now I've got a ton of texts. I just looked over. There's a ton of texts on Jussie Smollett. All right. I'm queuing up for the Facebook conversation. I want to talk about Facebook groups. Because the Facebook where I belong, like the Facebook group that I have, it's a mess. They had to split off. One page turned into two because one of the groups went rogue. Decided that it was too PC on the other page. And they were sugarcoating or not saying the truth about the neighborhood. And so they're fighting. It's constant fighting. It's constant fighting and then ripping on Kim Fox. Like, that's it. That's all they do. All right. 773 says, as much as I disliked our past mayor, you're wrong. Smollett is responsible for the expenses of the investigation. His lawyers are all about to boost their careers, all about boosting their own careers. We need to stop this nonsense and make them pay. Yeah, unless you're wrong, Tom. Because if you're wrong, I'm paying. That's my point. What about the risk? Is there anybody at the helm that's thinking about the risk? Johnson was an everyday thing. Smollett was a bad SNL skit that went way too long. Yeah. Falsifying a police report or covering up a possible crime like drunk driving. It's two different takes, but it's the same principle, says 773. I agree. That's the part that's what I'm trying to get at. Although 630 says, I think the difference is Jesse staged a premeditated hoax that had all sorts of racial and political connotations versus Eddie Johnson telling a lie about a human mistake. Yeah, again, I have a hard time with that one because I think we can go, I don't want to go through the story again. With Jussie Smollett. That's not the intention of talking about Jussie Smollett. But there's a lot of, I believe, from piecing together the story, there's a lot of stuff that we just kind of take for granted or we just assume was the case. 312-981-7200. Like I said, I don't want to get into that. We could talk about Jussie. We'll save Jussie for the Cook County State's Attorney meeting. When we have the op-ed meeting where they come in, they can just all talk about Jussie Smollett the entire time. All right. Nobody wants to talk about the... that's funny. Like, nobody wants to talk about the Facebook stuff. We'll get there. Let's go to Greg. Greg, what do you think of the... Are you worried? Are you worried? That's the question I want to ask. Are you worried, Greg?
Can you be more specific? There's a lot of things going on in this world. What do you want me to worry about?
Are you
first?
Just worried in general, Greg? No, Mike, are you worried that Jussie Smollett wins his countersuit and you have to pay out?
No, I don't think that'll ever go to court. The problem is Kim Fox owes us the money. If she had not dropped the case, Jussie Smollett would have gone before a judge. More than likely, he would have been found guilty. Hmm. He would have been fined. He would have been sentenced. That's where we would have recouped the money for the investigation.
See, Greg,
through the courts.
I don't know about that. I would argue that if you're holding her at face value, which nobody is, but if you're holding the state's attorney at face value, you would assume she looked at the cards that she had and she said, I ain't got enough to convict. She's going to go to a judge. We're going to lose. And more money would have been spent. And he would have been able to do the acquittal dance or the in all that kind of stuff. So I think that's another way to look at it, right?
Okay, and you're absolutely right on that point. But my point, because, all right, if we played it out that way, he still doesn't owe us the money.
Yeah.
Because it went through due process.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But I mean,
maybe there's no money to be got.
There's really not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a sad commentary, but there really isn't. I mean, we can't go back to him and say, oh, well, because we couldn't prosecute you, we want our money back.
Yeah, right.
It's like going to Vegas and saying, hey, I didn't get those three, you know, kings like I wanted. Right. Can I get my money back?
I've tried that. It doesn't work.
No, it really doesn't. All right.
Thanks, Greg.
And I would comment on your Facebook thing, but I'm not on Facebook.
Yeah, that's smart. You're pretty smart, buddy. Although you're not going to get that $200 they give back to the state of Illinois.
Yeah, but then again, start our conversation. You asked, what am I worried about?
Yeah.
I'm not worried about Facebook.
Yeah. Very good. That's so true. Thanks, Greg. He leaves a Facebook worry-free life. 312-981-7200. 815 says she didn't look. Talking about Kim Fox. That's the problem. Yeah. Well, if you, again, we live in an awesome world where we have speculation beats anything else. And I love that about it. I love it. But if you believed her story, she had recused herself and somebody else made that decision. If you believe it. Now, I can tell from all the people that are texting in right now, you don't. So she didn't look at it because at the end of the day, she had already moved out of having anything to do with it. All right, 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Facebook groups. Going once? I thought this would be a big deal. Pete and I both have had experiences where the Facebook group that represents your town, your neighborhood, your city. It was supposed to be a community bulletin board of neighbors getting together. It's actually gone in the wrong direction. And maybe it's just my neighbors, which I would not be surprised by. But I know this because I've read a couple of things about it, and people talk about it all the time, that their community group on Facebook is just kind of taken over by trolls. 312-981-7200, if that's your experience. Coming up, we'll talk retail. Got some other big stories to talk about, including Pete Rose. I would love to get into this because I believe that it's time that baseball let Pete Rose back in. Yesterday, he filed for another reinstatement. He's allowed to do that, by the way. When you read the deal that banned him from baseball in the 80s, he was periodically, I forgot how many years in between, he gets the opportunity to reinstate. The last one was in 2015. And they said no. But after what we saw with the Houston Astros sign stealing and the slap on the wrist they all got, after, I don't even know anyone get banned from baseball when it comes to steroids, now we're talking about, you know what, maybe they should all be in the Hall of Fame. How is what Pete Rose did any different than what they're doing? And if the times change and it's time to reinstate him, we'll do that combo too. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. 219 says, I'm in the Ravenswood Lincoln Square area. I love my next door group. It's very helpful. And 815 says, hey, must be your neighbors, pal.
I'm not denying that. Both Pete and I, we got into it, and we asked a couple other people in the office, and they, too, thought that the drama and the Facebook groups were losing sight of what they were created to be. Instead, it's just a bunch of trolls talking about national politics. Nobody wants that. Just want to know if there's going to be a Shake Shack coming to the neighborhood or the community. Is there a Sonic? There's no Sonic coming? All right. Ping me. Notify me when there's a Sonic. That's how I have it set up. All right, we'll move on. 312. Throw that one out. I got tons of them, guys. All day I've been here. Let's talk schools, shall we? All right, so I saw this story today. It's starting to get hot down in Springfield. Springfield is the spring session right about now, right in February, is when you start getting bills, like Destiny's Child once said, bills, bills, bills. This is the time of the year where there are bills, bills, bills. Every lawmaker is going to get their pet project at least in paper. We saw with Representative McSweeney talking about the bill to move forward to strike down the red light cameras in Illinois. That's moving forward. That's been a pet project to do that. And obviously there's some wind beneath the wings when it comes to corruption in Illinois. But this one grabbed my attention today. It's a pretty simple concept, but it's one that I think is controversial. This is from State Rep. Mark Batnick, Republican out of Plainfield. Should the state force Illinois state universities, at college level, U of I, Northern, Southern, anyone in the state system, should Springfield, the state of Illinois, force Illinois state universities to accept students? That's the talk. We talked last week about how NIU was moving away from using any standardized tests. Well, this state rep doesn't care, or they're not on the same page, because he's going in the exact opposite direction. He is saying that if any student that scores in the top 10% of the SAT or ACT, top 10%, no matter of any other requirement, they should automatically be granted admission to any state university. That includes the University of Illinois. This would be a bill, this would be a law on the books, on the record, that if an Illinois student, regardless of their grade point average, regardless of anything else, if they score in the top 10% in a standardized test, they get granted admission. They got to pay. But Representative Batnick, he's been talking about that we're losing a lot of students because they'll get a 31 or 32 on an ACT. And with that and a combination of their grades, they can't get into the prestigious engineering school at the University of Illinois. They end up going out of state where other universities, private or state or otherwise, will accept them. And he sees it as a brain drain that we're actually losing the ability to keep some great, smart students in the state. Okay. You know, obviously people are leaving Illinois en masse. This is a way that you could guarantee to kind of keep them here if their child was granted admission based on a test score. But I don't know. I'm not a socialist, as they say. But it sounds like the state is trying to force who gets in to the University of Illinois. I don't think that's right. I mean, I understand the concept of just the concept in general that if someone does really well on a test, they should be granted admission. And you would hope that would be happening anyway, because if you're scoring above a 30 on an ACT, congrats to you. I thought you could go anywhere you want. But apparently not. Apparently, it's very competitive at some of the state schools in Illinois, and that's just not good enough. Now, in this bill, it doesn't say anything about grade point average. It doesn't even say anything about projects or any other specialized requirements. This is just specifically saying
If they get in the top 10% on either the ACT or the SAT, they get in. And this is the exact opposite of what we talked about last week about NIU. So should we be promoting test results or should we be removing test results? It seems like this representative out of Plainfield and the state school that is Northern Illinois University are not talking to each other. It seems like that would be a very strange thing if NIU stepped forward and said, this is how we're going to do it. We're getting rid of tests. And then come spring, there's a law in the books that says, no, you're not. 312-981-7200. 815 says that's brain drain in reverse. 847 says, I'm in favor of the SAT-ACT proposal. But I'm a little biased because I tutor for ACT-SAT math prep. Oh, you're in high demand, I'll bet. I don't know. It seems to be the exact opposite. Now, we had a couple of side conversations, remember last week. Great stuff brought up by the listeners and the callers about there are a lot of other things that go into the idea that a GPA can be biased by the teachers that are in a system, the idea that a standardized test is standard for everybody, but people argue that it's not. The one thing we did bring up, and thanks 847 for texting in, was by removing test standards, you're also removing an industry of people who teach test standards. Right? People who, like 847, tutor. You wouldn't need a tutor if it didn't matter. We wouldn't have to shell out hundreds of dollars a month for a tutor if it didn't matter what you got on your ACT. So is this a push by the representative from Plainfield, because there's a little bit of interest from those industries? Can it get conspiratorial, perhaps? Or is it truly just about trying to keep the best students they can in the state of Illinois? I don't know of any Goodwill Hunting experiences where you had a student who's getting a 2.8 grade point average and he goes in and tests and gets a 34 on the ACT. Maybe that happens. I'm sure our tutor would let us know if that does. But it does seem that if you are getting a 30-plus on your ACT, and I only say that because that's the only test I know. I don't even know what the numbers are for SAT, to be honest, because we took ACT tests when I was in high school. I'm going back to my day, little early 90s. I don't know. I can't tell if that's actually happening. If somebody is scoring a 31, 32 on their ACT, and they've got a 3.5, 4-point GPA, they're not getting into the U of I? What? Has times changed that much? Is U of I that competitive that they're not getting in with those kind of numbers? Is that where we're at? 312-981-7200. Let's talk about this. I got a bunch of texts coming in. The calls are lining up. Wes, I'm going to get to you. I want to get to Vic Vaughn's news, which is coming up here. I got to get to it on time. So we'll come back. I'll get you, Wes. I'll get all the texts as well. And really, it comes down to, are you in favor of a good test score is going to get you, regardless, into a school? Or should the school have whatever guidelines they want? They shouldn't be a law on the books that says if a student gets a certain amount of grades that he automatically gets into school? That seems very uncollege-like. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break here. We're going to get Vic's news. We'll come back. We'll continue this, okay? Stay with us. 312-981-7200. There isn't room for students from Illinois because the number of overseas students that go to U of I are there, of course. That's something to think about. And there's a great text. There's so many great texts, but true test standards can be biased, but we don't need some standard other than monetary. Otherwise, just buy a degree. Such great stuff coming in. And I got Wes on the line. I got a bunch of texts, too, just about how this whole system could play out if, in fact, the state of Illinois guarantees people spots based on their test scores. We'll talk more about this right after Vic Vaughn's news here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman, 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. The phone number. We're on until 11 o'clock tonight. Last hour, we talked about whether or not former police superintendent Eddie Johnson should pay us back for the investigation into his lies, like we're trying with Jussie Smollett.
Before that, we talked about why Illinois should be the first state in the 2024 primary season. And coming up next hour, let's talk cheating in baseball. Is it time to let Pete Rose back? And if not, explain how the sign-stealing scandal in Houston didn't get any lifetime bans. Talk about that. We also have some retail conversations to have. Much more to do. Right now we're talking about, should the state force Illinois State Universities to accept students? There's a new bill that was filed aimed at keeping Illinois students in-state for college. The bill would say to any student in Illinois that got in the top 10% of either the ACT or the SAT, they would automatically be granted admission into any state university of their choice. Now, that's great if you want to keep students around who have a hard time getting into some of those schools, and therefore they go somewhere else. But it's also peculiar because I don't know if we really need the state telling us who can get in, who can't get into college. 630 says, I'm against the state regulating anything, especially Illinois, but look at it for what it's worth. These kids that go away to other state schools, they never come back. It ends up being a financial drain on the state. Let's go to Wes. He's been standing by. Wes, thanks for calling in.
I definitely think that the Illinois state government needs to step in and do something good, bad, or indifferent. The state has agreed to fund the state schools, and they have an obligation to provide higher education to Illinois residents. Like, when I was applying back in 2005 for the 2006 year, I needed a 35 on my ACT to get into the University of Illinois Engineering School.
Wow, that's crazy.
It is, and I'm sure it's even worse now with all the out-of-state and overseas students that they need to admit just to make the university financially solvent, according to the university.
Yeah, that's crazy. Thanks, Wes. Thanks for the call. That's mind-blowing. A 35? Are you kidding me? To get into the engineering department at the University of Illinois, you need a 35? And like I said, that was years ago. That's 10 plus years ago. It's probably more now. Can you get any higher than 35? I thought that was the 36 is the top. Well, that's then I understand. Should have got a 36, Wes. No, that's crazy. I must be in the minority. I would never think that was a requirement to get into school. It changes my thought on this a little bit. It seems like what we're really getting at here is that the standards, I mean, now again, we're just talking about one department or one school. But the standard, that's a very high standard. And hopefully that's applying to all the students from all over the world that want to come there. I hope it's not just, if you're in Illinois, it's a 35. If you're over in Japan, we'll take a 20. Just need to get you over here. Because at the end of the day, I know the system is a racket. Schools, like everywhere else, they have their main goals and mission, but they also know that they make a lot more money off of international students and people coming here for room and board. They are looking to maximize as much cash flow as they can. And so maybe there is something to it. Now, 630 points out the other side. What if the kid is a great test taker, but a poor student? There's a higher chance that student's going to flunk out. That's a great point. 870 says the same thing. If you remove the test standard, will everyone just start failing? So this is the point. When you follow a curriculum, you need to pass classes as prereqs for other classes. Students with poor GPAs and good test scores will be set up to fail and be filled with debt. Yeah, that's a really good point. Let's go to Rich. Rich, standing by. Rich, thanks for calling.
Hey. How you doing tonight?
I'm good. So what do you think about this? I find I was blown away at 35 to get into the engineering school at U of I. That's crazy.
Yeah, my theory is, why don't you just quit pushing college
sure.
and $200,000 or $500,000 student loans and start pushing these kids in high school to trade schools.
Yeah. I don't know how you do that. Maybe you could do that in Springfield, right? Maybe you could say, hey, here's some incentives. If you don't want to go to school, here's some incentives, so you go to trade school instead, and it's worthwhile for people who want to do that.
Right. I mean, you know, they allow college recruiters and military recruiters to go onto high school campuses to, you know, show kids, you know,
yeah, right,
options. Why don't they start pushing, like, getting a carpenter to go to school and tell the kids how if they go to trade school, they can make
a lot of
money. Know, $35 an hour to start,
yeah,
as opposed to, you know, going with minimum wage and you're going to pay for your school.
And Rich, you know, thanks for calling. I had that conversation not too long ago. I think it was a Download in Chicago Business where we were talking about, I forgot who it was with. It was with the a tradesman union, I think. They're talking about that the biggest problem right now is that they have so much construction. There are so many projects booming in a strong economy, and especially in downtown Chicago, in this area. But they don't have enough people who want to get into the business. They have, in some cases, six-figure jobs that they can't find anyone who wants to get into it. Now, I don't think that necessarily means that someone doesn't want to go to college or going to go to trade schools, but that is an issue. And you wonder if there is that glaring of a hole, why not, instead of spending time trying to get U of I to mandate state schools, why not just put some incentives into letting these kids have other choices and incentivize it? You throw tax breaks at Amazon. Throw some tax breaks at some kids who want to get in the trades. I mean, much more for that with my tax money than giving a huge compound to Sears out in Hoffman Estates. So 10 years later, you'd be like, man, it didn't work out. So we're going to have to raise your taxes again. 312-981-7200. When my friends were applying to U of I, says 630, they'd applied to the School of Agriculture, then switched their major a couple years later. They knew they couldn't get into the business school from out the gate, so they were playing games. Yeah, that's the hustle. That's a good Northern Illinois hustle. I think I did the same thing. Although I went to Columbia College, so my schooling was open enrollment. But I think there is this vibe that you can go get into the school and then you can make your own career after it. I don't know how it works with the engineering department. I don't know. 815 says it wouldn't waste as much of your tax money. And so they're saying, talking about incentives for trades. It's a good point. I don't know what to think of this because on face value, okay. The first thing I know is that state, any sort of colleges seem to operate independently of government. And I know that there are a lot of government, state colleges, all that kind of stuff. But they seem to set what kind of school they are, what kind of entrance exams you need, what kind of grades, what the cost is. It's U of I's more than NIU, things like that. So it seems a little weird to me that in this free market economy, that you would force them to take anything, right? I don't know how that works. That seems like a regulation, right? It's interesting. It's put up by a Republican in Springfield. It seems like that's the Democrats' stock and trade, right? More regulation. This seems like regulation in the sense that they're like going to tie the state university system to guaranteeing admission to anyone with a certain test score. Huh. I don't know how I feel about it. There are a lot of conspiracy theories. That's why I love my next guest, Jefferson. Hey, Jefferson. Good to talk to you again.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
You know, I wanted to talk about this last week when the conversation was about, the topic was about Northern Illinois.
Right.
Yeah. So I think here's the reality of it. And like a lot of my views, you know, they're going to be construed as classist or racist or sexist or whatever.
You already know that. That's your prereq to anything you're about to say.
That's right. That's the footnote. I think people need to look at the reality of what's going on in Illinois. It's no secret we're losing population.
Uh-huh.
There's less kids going to college.
Uh-huh.
If you go to college, you statistically are going longer. You may also be starting college later in life.
Right.
There are more women going to college than men now. There's more females on campus.
Okay.
Greater number of minorities, and historically there have been, although their success rate is sort of stumbling. And, okay, you know, there's going to need to be a day of reckoning in this state. Eastern Illinois, Governor State, Chicago State,
they're
for
all
sure.
In trouble, right?
Southern Illinois. You know, I don't want to take away the economy and the jobs of some of these smaller communities, but we can't afford to sustain 11 or 12 state schools like we used to because the enrollment's not there. And while as a taxpayer, I think it's fair that if you do graduate from a high school in Illinois, that you should be able to go to some college.
Absolutely.
I'm not so sure that this promise, this broad-based promise, global promise, that you can just get into any school, with the exception, of course, of University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, is really is fair to the student or fair to the taxpayer. Right. Something's got to give.
Yeah, you're right. The only issue I have is that if the University of Illinois is choosing a certain student, an international student or someone else that's not from the state of Illinois, and the grades and the ACTs are all the same, maybe there is some truth to the state of Illinois saying we're losing people. We have to have a guaranteed spot for these kids. If we don't have a guaranteed spot, they're leaving. They'll go to Brown.
I see that. I did my graduate work at and it wasn't in engineering or computers or architecture. It was public administration. I did it at IIT in the evenings. And about halfway through my tenure, boatload, pardon the pun, of Chinese kids were coming in to sustain the program.
Yeah, right.
These kids were paying full freight. The government in China was paying for them to come, and you hit it on the head 10, 7, 5 minutes ago, whenever it was. They are full freight.
Full freight.
That is cash.
No, I know that story well.
To these schools.
Yeah.
And that's another part of the problem. We support these schools through, and it's a growing, it's a shrinking number of the general revenue of the state budget, I grant you, but it's still publicly supported. So while part of me, you know, says one thing, I do think that kids that graduate from Illinois as Illinois residents, right?
Right.
There needs to be an opportunity there for them.
Thank you.
I just don't think it should be artificial.
Yeah,
like this proposal.
I think I'm with you. Thanks, Jefferson. That's a great call. I think everything you said is right on. I think there's a problem in the system right now, and I can't tell if this is correcting it or if there's some different scam in it. I can't tell. You can never tell with a bill coming out of Springfield, right? But if the idea is that the university system in the state of Illinois is rigging it against kids from Illinois, they're saying, okay, we don't get as much money. When they come, it's that's the state level. But man, if I go over to China or I go to Europe or other parts of Asia, they're going full freight, and they got to pay an international tax, and they got to stay in housing. And there's just more money to be made by the university. So if a student is coming to one of the departments who is from Tokyo, and they have a 32 on an ACT and a 4.0, and they're going against a kid from Schaumburg who's got the same grades, the school is getting more money from the international student. And maybe that's what this Republican rep from Plainfield, Batnick, is talking about. I would buy that. At a certain point, you'd think that this would be right out of national politics playbook for the election. And it's almost, if you just said, okay, let's not use the word student, let's use the word trade, let's use the word industry, let's use the word, I don't know, steel. It's unacceptable in America. You can't have companies, and they do it all the time, and it was a big rallying cry for the president in 2016 and his campaign here. And big rallying cry how American businesses are going elsewhere because they can get more money for it. We got to keep them here. Same argument here. If a kid is living in Plainfield, Schaumburg, Romeoville, Peoria, the whole concept at the beginning of the day when we're talking about a state university system is that they had an affordable place to go for college. And what we've seen over time is the University of Illinois, and they're probably the biggest culprit, going, we can make more money by charging more money for out-of-state, out-of-country students, and they can, the other kid from Romeoville can go to NIU. That's not right. That's absolutely not right. So maybe they're onto something. 815 says, yeah, it's a different scam. My folks worked their butts off to send me to college. What's the deal today? I don't know. 708 says kids won't go into the trades until the social stigma of working in the trades goes away. What's a social stigma? I don't know what your age is. I'm 45. I'm not sure that the social stigma goes beyond my generation. Maybe it is. Maybe the generation Y or Z or millennials or whatever it is. Maybe there's some stigma there. But the contractors and the people I know that work in the trades, they're the ones that are like, hey, you want to come up to my skybox? You know what I mean? They're not social stigma. These guys, you know, I'm a working class guy who's got no money to my name, but I know how to use a hammer. And, no, these guys are making cash. They're the ones that are making cash in this society. Us egghead talk show hosts, we're on the way out. So I don't know about that. Keep going here. The trades do visit high school, say 708. That's good to know. 708 says, yeah, why aren't we do need young people in trades? Why push college? I know college grads with no common sense and poor work ethic, that's for sure. Their parents worked hard to put them through college, and they don't appreciate it. Some, not at all. Yeah. The only social stigma with the trades, says 630, is that it's hard work and sometimes you get dirty. That's true. 847 says, Justin, it's the schools. The schools are pushing the kids into all AP classes. The AP classes are watered down, and they push them away from the trades. A huge mistake. Now, don't get me started on the AP classes. I feel like that's another segment. I don't know. I sniffed that out. The state of Indiana, we'll get into that. State of Indiana, did they get caught? Someone was explaining this to me at around the holidays. That the AP classes, you gotta pay to have AP classes. The school does. That's a trademark thing. It's not just something you're just like, oh, we have AP, we have advanced classes. That's a whole thing. So there's a bunch of money tied up in that with textbooks and a trademark to have an AP class, all that kind of stuff. And there's some corruption that goes along with that as well, or at least some suspect conflict. Let's go to Paul. Paul, what's your thought on trades instead of college?
My thought is that I think that the least generation or half a generation behind us have seen their parents struggle so much to work as many hours as they do in the trades.
Yeah.
And they've given their children so much, because that's how the world works. And so therefore, these children see their parents either gone at dry cleaners or bricklaying jobs or whatever they may be, even if they're the owners of these companies, they still spend a lot of time. And so I think that people generally say to themselves, oh, I don't want to work as hard as my parents did.
Yeah, right.
And so therefore, it comes down to a situation where they've almost scared them away from hard work. Because I can tell you this, my children, they don't carry manual jobs. You know, I mean, they shy away from manual jobs. Whereas in my generation, back in the 70s, we raked leaves, we cut lawns, we washed windows, shoveled snow. This is how it goes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now, if you get good grades, you can get a job where all you do is push paper and tap on a computer.
I was going to say push paper. You get good grades, and you don't have to ever touch paper again.
Right, exactly.
Thanks, Paul. That's a great call. Good conversation, guys. 630 says, I worked for the railroad for 42 years. I made mid-six figures. You can keep your college education. That's interesting ebb and flow to this convo. The trades kind of took over as, you know, maybe it's not about mandating at the state that someone should get into college. Maybe it's about thinking about how much value college is. This is simple. All right, we'll take a break here. Come back. Let's talk about retail. Did you see the story out of Dallas today? There is a 7-Eleven they are testing out. I think it's in Irvine, Texas. Irvine. Irving, yeah. That they have a 7-Eleven that is cashierless, like the Amazon stores here. 7-Eleven is testing out the corner store without a cashier. Not a self-checkout, just without a cashier. They're going to go with the app vibe where you can go in, they know what you picked up, and you get charged. Is that the future of retail? Let's talk about that. Would you go to that 7-Eleven? Would you feel comfortable walking through there? Only if they still had the hot dogs in rotation on the on the burner, right? 312-981-7200. It's Justin Kaufman at 720 WGN. Tune in to Bob Surratt tomorrow to hear Greg Kot. That's a great story. I mean, Greg Kot has been 30 years probably, maybe a little longer. Leaving, taking the buyout at the Chicago Tribune. Will the story we're going to talk about tomorrow night is, will the Chicago Tribune replace him? This is the year of Chicago music. The city of Chicago came out with that at the beginning of the week, saying this is the year, 2020 will be the year of Chicago music. And then the first big announcement is that the premier rock critic, maybe in all of the country, is taking a buyout, and he is out. 312-981-7200. Okay, so I pitched, this is amazing, a 7-Eleven in Irving, Texas has opened. It's a test. I think they have the headquarters there. It's a pilot store. It's a 700 square foot 7-Eleven that uses a mixture of algorithms and predictive technology to separate individual customers and their purchases from the other customers in the store. So there is no cashier. This is what they do similarly with the Amazon stores, the Amazon Go stores that are concepted here in Chicago. So it's going to have all your popular products sold at traditional 7-Elevens, drinks, snacks, groceries, roller food, hopefully. Roller food, as a texter pointed. And here's what the 7-Eleven senior vice president said. Ultimately, our goal is to exceed customers' expectation for faster, easier transactions and a seamless shopping experience. There are requirements to actually shop in this store, though. To test the store, because it's a test, it's only employees right now. You got to download an app, you got to sign up to a page, and you got to check in at the store before you shop. So you don't have to scan. Maybe it's a scanner or something where you have to check in so they know you're there. The receipt for the purchase automatically appears in the app when you exit the store. This is fantastic. Now, the reason I want to talk about this is we talked about this last week with all the closings that have been in retail in the last couple months. I mean, January is just such a down month. You saw the story earlier this week that Macy's is closing 125 stores. This right here, 7-Eleven, whatever they're doing, and of course there's the implication of losing jobs, and if there's no cashier, if it's cashierless, then that means there's no cashier. But they are hedging their bet that the future of retail is an isolated experience. When you go into a store and you're not bothered by another human being. Greg, would you shop at a 7-Eleven that was cashierless?
I would not. You know, I don't go to the store. It's hard to get me to go to a store as it is. But the one reason I go is for socialization. Okay. And I would gladly pay more, you know, for employees who are there to say hello to me, to greet me when I'm a customer. I would gladly pay for that. You know, I don't like doing the kiosks. Plus, I'd like to bring up another point, like, I'm totally blind, so the kiosks probably won't, you know, be voice sensitive. So
that's a good point. They'd have to do that. They'd have to do it by, wouldn't they? Don't all stores have to do that? You would know best, right?
Well, they quote unquote do, but they don't. Right. If you know what I mean, like they get away with what they can. They have. I was like, I'm totally blind. That. One store, what can you offer me? Well, we have a large print, you know, machine that you can use. I'm like, I can't even read that. You know,
I don't think
Braille.
You heard me, right? That's terrible. The but that I would just assume that they would have to think about that just based on Equal Rights and Disability Act stuff, right? Doesn't 7-Eleven have to think about that stuff? I never think about it because I'm not blind, but I would think you would have to do that. But you're saying stores just kind of skirt around it.
Yeah, and you know, I just like the whole fact of someone. I don't know. Maybe I'm old fashioned, but
no,
I just
you're not
I'm going to be 42 tomorrow. But
happy
I just like the whole. Thank you. I just like the whole point of someone saying hi to me. You know.
Yeah.
Hey, how are you doing? Yeah. You know, I like to make conversation with a person.
I like it. Thanks, Greg. Thanks for the call. That's a interesting concept. All right, Donovan's on the line. Donovan, I'm interested. You're saying that you're part of a Costco no technology type thing there. What's going on there?
Well, have you been to a Costco before?
Yeah.
Okay, so you realize we don't have all those bells and whistles. We don't have the security. We actually
right.
have people checking your receipt.
Right.
We don't have any of that security. And, that concept of not having the human interaction will not work for them. They're going to end up losing money. They will be closing due to the fact of labor costs. And I'm not talking about labor costs of actual processing the orders, but someone has to track all that. All you're doing is shifting your payroll.
Right,
you're just shifting
right.
your payroll from one
it.
Thing to the other. And then you're also you're inviting more and more theft.
And you're also, the turnstile kind of thing?
Yeah, you're alienating. Your last caller was correct. And I've been a cashier for 30 years, on and off. I've done every department in Costco. I was in management, stepped down because, honestly, they pay our cashiers a lot of money. I mean, between insurance and everything, I'm making just about $100,000.
Okay, wow. That's
so,
great. Yeah.
A lot of people, because no one knows who we are or what we pay. The glass door is totally wrong. You can't go to that website. But the bottom line is, I do greet my members, and I actually call them by their first name. Half of them I do know by face because they're there every day almost. We have regulars.
Yeah, no,
probably
no
more,
doubt. Right.
More so than Circle K does or Amazon.
Yeah.
But people don't know this, but at Costco, for instance, we buy the product. Our buyers are in Chicago. I'm in your region. Your region goes all the way down to Louisville, Kentucky.
Wow. Where are you at?
Well, I don't want to tell you because I'm telling you some secrets here.
your secrets are safe with us. We appreciate the call.
But basically, the buyer buys for 45 buildings. There's about 45 Costco per region. And so they get the price point of buying in huge quantities.
Right, that's
the... And they only mark it up 4% above their cost. So it's the same price and product at every Costco in America, basically, because it's the same premise, the same concept. Buy it, so it's 4% above your cost. We only make money off the membership base.
Right.
And as far as the speed goes...
Smart.
They time us. They
yeah.
want us to do over 50 orders per hour. That's a lot of orders.
That's
so
a
they
lot
actually
of orders,
time
yeah.
order. So,
absolutely.
And when you come in, if you check out your own stuff and you're not a cashier, it's your job, you're not going to be very fast.
That's amazing point, yeah. Donovan. I appreciate that. Thanks for the call. That's something that we didn't think about. And I'm glad he chimed in here. What happens when, I mean, again, it's not self-checkout. So 7-Eleven is going with a cashier list. They don't want to do anybody in the store. They want to do it. If you go to the Amazon stores here in Chicago, there's nobody in there. And when you pick up an item and you walk out, it knows you have the item and it charges your card. It's different in the way that they're not sell, because you're absolutely right, Donovan. That's where the Targets and Jewels, and I really do want to have our constitutional convention for society to talk about how we handle some of these things, like when it comes to self-checkout. But you're right. If there is not a cashier in the building who's actually on the line, you can't be efficient because it's on the customer. But they're looking past that. Patrick, you're on the line. Patrick,
hey.
What do you think of this? Would you go to
call up for Patrick?
Oh, no.
I'm saying they did it in Rockford, and it happened for a week.
Really?
I'm saying?
Yeah, driving or something.
Yeah, I was like, there's nobody there, so they lost product that way because they were doing the self checkout like you
right,
were.
Right, 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 right.
And again, I
but that doesn't
I don't
work, right?
Any of those places, if like Jewel's after 10,
yeah,
they don't have any cashiers.
They don't. This
they have one person standing
right.
at the right. self checkout.
Right.
And they have a person standing there. So, like, if you want to buy alcohol, because that, you know, you can't ring up alcohol yourself. It has
right,
to be
right.
a person
Got somebody there. Right.
And I make them ring me up because I don't work there, and it's very aggravating to me to have those self checkouts because to me, you're first off.
What was your name again?
Patrick.
Patrick.
Okay, Patrick. I'll let you go. That only happens in talk radio, right? I give Patrick so much credit. He's at a drive-thru? He's getting dinner? The guy's completely confused. Who are you talking to? Again, I'm with you, Patrick, and I'm with you, Donovan, and I'm with so many, but this is different. There are no self-checkouts. There are no cash registers. 7-Eleven has gone beyond what the Jewel or the Mariano's or the Whole Foods or even any of the self-checkout places that you go. They're beyond that. They're going to a style, and one of our texters knows exactly what I'm talking about. 708 says, love Amazon Go. Absolutely would do 7-Eleven like that. It's essentially a room of products. You go in, the minute you walk out of the door, they know what you bought and they charge you. It's the kind of technology that blows your mind. It's like Portillo's drive-thru. Like, how do you know so many people in this drive-thru? How do you know which one's mine? But Amazon is perfecting it right now, and they've been the ones that have been at the forefront. But you're seeing other retailers go in that direction. It is not a self-checkout situation. It is a no-checkout situation. And you heard the vice president at 7-Eleven say, this is about exceeding the expectations of customers in the 21st century. They're saying this is what you want. Is it? 312-981-7200. David, is this what you want, a cashierless 7-Eleven?
I don't, Justin. I think there's a lack of human contact and interaction that takes place in this day and age we live in. And you know, I think the future of mankind can be summed up in one thing, and that is one big, giant Edward Hopper painting. You know what I mean?
Splashed everywhere, right?
I mean, it's a shame he's not alive today, because the opportunities this guy could get for human isolation and loneliness is just fantastic. You know?
Bringing some art to the conversation. I appreciate it, David. Yeah, I guess I don't know how isolating the experience is, because if I'm going to a 7-Eleven, I'm not sure that 7-Eleven or Amazon Go, in this case, what they do here, is where I'm looking for my human interaction. There are other places for that. There are other community places, the bar, the coffee shop, the restaurant, our families. Our friends. I'm not sure that the world lives and breathes and dies by the fact that we wouldn't have interaction with a cashier at 7-Eleven. They don't necessarily. I get it. I totally get what you're saying. There's a new store that just opened up a block for me. I walked in there. I couldn't tell you how happy I was to be able to shake hands and talk to the guy about opening the store. Have a casual conversation about the weather. I walked out. My son goes, why did you have to talk to him? And I was like, what? He essentially was like, that didn't think that that was even a thing, that you're allowed to talk to cashier. I loved it. He was a store owner. There's no doubt about it. There's a place for that. But I also think I would really enjoy walking into a 7-Eleven and walking out. What I wanted. And I didn't have to stand in a line, and I didn't have to necessarily be bothered by the experience or the other customers, got what I wanted, and I was out. I don't think 7-Eleven's wrong here. I think it is the future of retail. And the issue why I bring up Macy's is Macy's didn't change. They never changed. Macy's is a department store like a department store was in the 50s. Big tables with polo shirts on it, different brands and different spots, tons of sales clerks everywhere, but there's still a line of four people. An experience, don't get me started with temperature control in the old Marshall Field building. It's hot. Big back. Like, everything about it is a retail experience from the past. Is it time to start thinking like 7-Eleven's thinking that there is a future? 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. Come back, continue. Would you do it? I'm trying to get through your head because it's not a self-checkout. There's no checkout. I know that's hard to understand, but they told you predictive technology and apps and everything in between has figured out a way to know exactly what's in your hand, what you pulled off of the spot, what you took out of the store. And talk to many Amazon Go customers, they're not wrong. You think right off the bat, I know, I think right off the bat, I'd be looking at the receipt going, I didn't order a bag of Doritos. Going back in there trying to argue with nobody. They don't get it wrong. So would you want an experience like this where you just kind of walk in and grab it and you're gone? Almost like the old experience with the newspaper stand downstairs when I used to work in the Clark and Adams building. You just drop the 50 cents on the table, you know, and grab the thing. You don't even have to wave or whatever. You got the attention. That kind of thing, but without the attention, without the wave. All right, we'll take a break. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. So many great comments coming in and phone calls. 312-981-7200. 630 says, I would absolutely use this type of no checkout store. I hate lines. I hate small talk with strangers. 815 says, maybe they could adapt this technology to the car purchasing situation. That's a great point. I don't want to take away people's jobs, but that would be a great place to have a salesperson free zone. There are others, though, that say the other way around. Like Mary, as she's told us before, she totally rocks the self-checkout. But even I'm stymied when the computer won't proceed. I still need to stand there and wait for someone to correct the computer. But I also enjoy and I need the human interaction. It's scientifically proven that humans need to have face-to-face contact for better mental health. It's uplifting to have a little conversation with the checkout. And I don't disagree. This well said. But at the same time, I just get it somewhere else. And maybe there aren't a lot of interactions. Maybe that's what we're hearing is that people don't have the interactions to go to different places. Or I mean, I crave it, right? We all do as humans. I host a talk show. You guys are my friends. I crave the interaction. That's great. So maybe I'm not the right person because maybe when I get to the 7-Eleven, I don't want to talk anymore. Just want to get in and get out. 708 says it's also cashless. The problem that's being brought up over and over and over here is about cigarettes and alcohol. How do you regulate that if you don't have somebody on site to check an ID? Okay, I'm going to throw it out there. The app is 21 and over. Or if it's 21 and under, you have to prove you're 21 for the app that's on your phone. Now, you're absolutely right. Someone could have a different phone, still working this out. But there has to be a way with the predictive technology that they know who you are. They're using predictive technology. So they already know what you bought last time, the time before. They know why you're in a 7-Eleven. For me, the taquitos, the roller food. The minute I walk in there, they're like, the app is buzzing and leading me to the hot dog roller. And I don't know how they do it. Maybe they don't. Maybe 7-Eleven says we're out of the alcohol business, which I would find incredibly, I'm pessimistic on that call. But maybe they are. 708 says they have employees for stocking, and they must have employees for selling alcohol. Maybe. I don't know. The Amazon Go stores don't do alcohol, I don't think. That might be the one area that it's not. But There has to be ways around it. There has to be. And it takes us to, we're talking about the future. Nobody wants to get into this stuff because it gets real creepy. Well, what about facial recognition? What about some sort of scan? If you want to buy the alcohol, you have to scan something on your phone or scan your license, the back. That's how they do it at Target now. Drives me crazy. Every time I go into Target, they take the scanner and hit the back of my license. I got a scanner on the back, and it tells them what the deal is. Or they're just, I don't know what they're doing. I hate it. I don't want you to be able to, I don't want to be a barcode on the back of my license. So maybe you could use that kind of technology. Maybe you have to unlock the door, you have to, do you have to slide your license in? Now I get it, the idea being, how do you stop teenagers from stealing a license and putting in there, or cutting off your face to use that technology, like Face Off? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I'm sure there are much smarter people listening than I that could figure out how to do predictive technology when it comes to 21 and over. 630 says, I agree. There are other communities for human interaction. I'm not looking for great conversation with strangers when I'm running errands. I want to be able to run into a place, get what I need, and get out. This sounds like a smart idea. 7-Eleven is evolving. Hmm. 847 says your ID driver's license has a scanner card. They scan to buy cigarettes at stores now, so you just use that. Same thing. That's what I was just talking about. It drives me crazy. There's nothing I hate more. I don't like the idea. I know, and I'm so ignorant and so stupid. In the way that I think that that's the only way they're tracking me. But I hate the fact that I want to get my six-pack of Zima. Get my six-pack of hard seltzer. And then they scan the thing. I'm like, now they know when I bought booze and, when's the last time. Pretty soon they're going to hit the thing and be like, I don't know. You just bought a six-pack like 2 days ago. What's going on? Look at that belly. You need to stop. They're going to be judgy cashiers. Watch out for that. There's an Amazon Go, 708 says, by the station at Michigan Wacker. Yeah, I know that's one. I know that one. I don't have the app, though, on my phone. Don't get me wrong. I just anti-Amazon app, so I can never go in there. So I like to stand right outside and be like, can I use your phone real quick? Can I use your phone? Hey, can I use your phone? Never works. They say that the one that just opened by Prudential 2 both sell alcohol. So check them out. See how they do it. Can I borrow your phone? Great conversation now, guys. All right. 312-981-7200. We continue. I love it because I think that this shows one company that's trying to get ahead. And you see a lot of other companies that are still relying on rayon shirts and two-for-ones. I get two rayon shirts. The second one, 50% off. Are you listening now? No, we're not listening. So some companies are deciding the future of technology and retail, and others are falling behind. I think that's where we're at in 2020. All right, let's talk about Pete Rose. I'm into this story because I always thought Pete Rose was a bad, bad man. And now, after watching the way that he's got one set of standards and everybody else, I think he should be reinstated to Major League. I don't know what that gets him, but I think he should be. Let's talk about it. 312-981-7200. Take a break. Come back. Vic Vaughn's got the news. Stay with us. Justin Kaufman here, 720 WGN, with you till 11 o'clock tonight. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Last hour, we talked about the future of cashierless retail, whether or not the state should force Illinois universities to take on Illinois students. Early in the show, we talked about whether or not former police superintendent Eddie Johnson should pay us back for the investigation into his lies, like we're trying to do with Jussie Smollett. Before that, we talked about why Illinois should be the first state in the 2024 primary season. Throw in some coronavirus stats, a community Facebook group conversation. We've covered a lot of ground tonight, but we are not done. Coming up later this hour, we'll look at a new study that pinpoints the signature drinks for all 50 states. The one for Illinois, total bogus. Ridiculous. Like they went to some, I don't even know what they did. They went to a hipster bar and thought it'd be tongue in cheek to say, because if you look at all the states, it'd be like a Arizona tequila sunrise, Alabama whiskey, Illinois Malort. Are you kidding me? Have you ever had Malort? Do you even know what Malort is? I understand that it's kitschy, that that's the drink of choice, that's the alcohol of choice. And that is like guzzling Drano. That is not the signature drink of people who live in Illinois. Sorry. I know you're being funny, but it's not. What is? I don't know. That's a better question. Maybe a question for the listeners. Pete Rose, let's get into it because I got a ton of texts. Oh my gosh. I thought maybe I'd have to make my case to get into this conversation, what we're talking about here, but everybody has already responded. I got 15, 20 texts we're going to get to in just a second. So what we're talking about tonight, Pete Rose yesterday had filed for reinstatement into baseball. He was banned back in the 80s now for gambling on games. And there is some truth to the fact that he lied about it and tried to cover it up and did everything he possibly could. And then he finally was banned. And part of the deal with Major League Baseball back at that time was he could periodically file to be reinstated. He could petition the league or a new commissioner. So it was a lifetime ban that kept him out of the game and the family, and I would assume some of the economic and financial rewards of doing that. But every so often, I think it's maybe 5 years, he can petition the league. He's at that point. He's petitioning the league. And this time his lawyers are saying, listen, you have proven with what just happened in Major League Baseball that this is a corrupt sport. That you have a full team using technology that's fully against the rules to win world championships. They are gaming the system. They are cheating. Not to mention, a couple years ago, you had people putting banned substances in their bodies to hit baseballs further humanly possible. In both cases, which Colt were right up there, they're cheating, they're gaming the system. The response from Major League Baseball was tepid. Anyone who looks at what happened with the Houston Astros, they won their championship. They didn't get their championship vacated. They scapegoated a coach and a GM who are, what, out for a year, suspended for a year? None of the players who actually were the ones doing the cheating got any suspensions? Maybe that'll change if investigations come out, including if any of those players were wearing a buzzer. But when you truly look at it, Major League Baseball kind of did a slap on the wrist. Ah, you know what, hey. Good thinking, but it's against the law. It's against the rules. So Pete Rose is saying, if I am out for what I did, and what I did was so horrendous, then either they should be out or you should avoid the double standard and I should be back in. 312-981-7200. I don't know. He kind of has a point. I think he has a point. I'm not a Pete Rose guy. Pete Rose didn't really have much of a Chicago connection. Played against us. Goofy years with the Expos. Everyone knows him as, on the Big Red Machine. He was Cincinnati Red for life. And he showed up on, was he a player manager for the Expos? Or was it the Padres? One of those teams he was, the Phillies? Yeah, he had a lot of stops towards the end of his career. I remember the one time he was up, I remember this play where he hit a line drive and it bounced off of the pitcher and I think Larry Boa caught it on the fly and they got the double play. And I just remember that. That's all I remember about Pete Rose in the 80s. That's it. And then he cheated and Marge Schott was involved. That's all I remember. 312-981-7200. 815 says, hey, all night we've been talking about standards. We talked about standards for academics earlier. But what about standards for sports? 815 says, do we have no standards at all? 312 says, we're in the 80s. I watched Pete Rose dive 3 rows into the stands for a foul ball. He paid plenty. His penalty was huge. Let him back in. P. Pete Rose is garbage, says 630. I worked security at Wrigley when he was a player, and he treated people like they were beneath him. Huh. Maybe I'm biased, but I think that they wait until a year after he dies to put him in. Oof. If they could do it to a nice guy like Ron Santo, they should do it to a guy like Pete Rose. Well, that probably goes a long way, you know, 630. You may be right. You're working security at Wrigley. If he had that persona and that attitude, you can understand why maybe it's not unlike Blagojevich, where you're like, wow, he really got a huge sentence. I wonder why. And you're like, yeah, I think I know why. Mike, what do you think? Should Pete Rose get back in?
Hey, Justin, how are you? Yeah, you know what, man? Listen, you hit it on the head a couple seconds ago. Look, there's been Barry Bonds and Sammy Sosa, right, and all this other stuff that's happened, and these guys have just got the Red Sox and the Astros just got caught cheating. Look, in this day and age, and it's happening for the last 10 years when fantasy sports betting is so prevalent now, you don't think everybody in America and everybody on all those sports teams with social media and everything and these young millennials with all this money, you don't think they're betting?
Right.
Come on. No, everybody's betting. Everybody's doing it.
Yeah, I wonder. You know what gets weird, Mike, is when you think about fantasy baseball, which is at the core is betting. But think about all the times they joke around about it. I mean, the reporters ask them questions in the locker room and they're like, oh, I wish I was on my team or what. Yeah, no doubt.
Absolutely. That's my point.
Yeah, it's a point. Yeah. Great point. Thanks, Mike.
So you know what? Hey, come on. I mean, it happens with football, the other stuff that goes on, you know, and why do you think there's all these prop bets and you know, with Super Bowl every year? Look, it's like, yeah, you know what? Let the guy in.
Yeah.
You know, everybody else is going to get in. Everybody else has done whatever. It's just nobody.
Yeah,
because
it's time.
People's gotten, everybody's good until you get caught.
Yeah. Means, you know, exactly. He's got 25, 30 years on it already. Thanks, Mike. All right, let's talk Jeff. Jeff, what do you think? It's time to let Charlie Hustle back in?
Yeah, I read a biography of Pete Rose this year because I wanted to revisit the whole issue. And I was always an anti-Pete Rose guy, and I just remember everything he's done for baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the things that we have to consider is the writers let him into the Hall of Fame.
Right.
And when I read the book, he basically lied from 1989 to 2004, and when he finally admitted it.
Came through, right.
So you got 15 years there, and I always figure they're going to make him wait 15 more years for every year he lied, which would take you to today.
Right.
I think the mitigating factor is a lot of people will blame Bart Giamatti's death, at least in part, on Pete Rose. And the frustration that he caused Bart.
Oh, yeah, right.
And Bart was pretty well loved. So.
Yeah, that's right. And it all comes down, again, it comes down to personalities and whether you're well loved and the people you're against, you're well loved. Absolutely. Good point, Jeff. 815 says, so betting on baseball now makes it right? Still, no. 312 says, if Ty Cobb is in, don't you think Pete Rose should be in too? Seems like everybody wants him back in, huh? Jim, it seems like everybody wants him back in. You? You there, Jim?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. No, he's a scumbag. You know, he abused his wife. I don't care what he did on the field. He cheated. He lied about it. He covered it up. He does not deserve to get in. Those other guys on steroids, the same thing.
Yeah.
I don't care. And I'm not a purist at all. I don't give a crap what they do. But
right.
He was just saying, such a scumbag about it, he should never get in.
Yeah, there you go. All right, I appreciate it, Jim. Thanks for that strong opinion. 312-981-7200, getting some great stuff. And a lot of stuff along the lines of Jim saying, listen, character has to be in play here, and Pete Rose's character is in question. It's not like he was an angel, and I don't mean a California angel. I mean, he probably was at some point. He played on every team. But he doesn't seem to have the love. You don't hear a lot of people stepping forward and saying, you know, oh, Pete Rose meant so much to me, or Pete Rose, you know, did this and that for me. So 312-981-7200. Let's go ahead and take a break here. Come back, and we'll continue here. I got a ton of texts to get to, so we'll keep doing it. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Pete Rose wants to be reinstated into baseball. And his lawyers and Pete Rose believe that the precedent has been set by the way that the league today dealt with the sign-stealing scandal with the Houston Astros. They got one-year bans, the coach and the GM. A couple of draft picks were docked, the players scot-free. So why is Pete Rose sitting out of baseball with a lifetime ban when obviously the new Major League Baseball doesn't seem to care? And if you really truly want to look at it, they didn't really care about steroids either. It was Congress. If you remember that, Congress got involved talking about the integrity of the game and whether or not literally it was juiced. That's when Sammy Sosa's like, I don't speak English. Classic move. But if you're going to start arguing about Pete Rose, don't you have to start making arguments for the steroid players? Roger Clemens? Barry Bonds? Mark McGwire? Is Mark McGwire in or out? He's out, right? He's out. Sammy Sosa? Sammy Sosa was a Hall of Famer. I'm not a Cubs guy, but man, Sammy Sosa was such a great player. Steroid user, allegedly. But do you make an argument for those guys? I think if they're, and that argument is happening. When you talk about the Hall of Fame, I guess I'm talking about the Hall of Fame. But do you make an argument, if you're going to start making an argument that guys like Barry Bonds, Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa, Roger Clemens, they're all going to be accepted into the Baseball Hall of Fame because at the end of the day, it was a different time, steroids, then don't you have to do the same thing with Pete Rose? And I'm not talking about the Hall of Fame. In this case, just reinstated. Let him back in. Justin says, character should have something to do with getting into the Hall of Fame. Well, what about Ty Cobb? He was a huge racist. He's in. Okay. 815 says he's a flawed man. Should we forgive him? Yes. Should baseball? Maybe not. 224, players are abusing their spouses or children, arrested and accused of DUIs, abusing drugs over and over again, and all they're getting is game suspensions. Gambling is a lesser of all those evils. 847, hi, Justin. Rose should be in the Hall of Fame as a player. What he did after his playing days is when he was a manager. That's a great point, Jack. As somebody else pointed out as well, he never cheated in baseball. The steroid guys cheated. They put needles in their body of banned substances to get an advantage to win the game on the field. The Houston Astros slammed bats against garbage cans to get an advantage on the field in the game of baseball they were playing. Pete Rose, whether you like him or not, had nothing to do with playing the game. When he was on the field, he was all hustle. And unless there was a steroid in the 70s and 80s we don't know about, which it could have been. Definitely certain substances, I'm sure. But he was playing the game fairly. It was what he did off the field. Which maybe makes an argument for why Major League Baseball has not let him back in. The other guys, maybe that's the argument that they make to say what they did on the field is less egregious than what you do off. I don't know. It's hard to justify it. That's the issue, right? It's absolutely hard to justify committing to keeping Pete Rose out when Major League Baseball, on the other hand, is letting these players stay in. They cheated like crazy, the Houston Astros. They're accused of, the internet went crazy, this is unfounded, they're accused of putting wires through on their bodies so that they know what pitch is coming. Bzz, bzz. Oh, that's curveball. Bzz. It's fastball. 312 says, Rose paid the price. He should be reinstated. It's been decades. He was the all-time hits king. 315 says, let the U.S. senators vote on Pete Rose. They need something to do now that the impeachment's over, right? 773 says, any player that hits their spouse should be banned from baseball forever. Yeah, absolutely. But there are many cases of that not being the case, including, I mean, wasn't Aroldis Chapman suspended for 60 games? Wasn't it a 60-game, 80-game suspension for his domestic abuse? While he was suspended, the Cubs traded for him. So it's obvious that that is not something that Major League Baseball cares about. 847, we're holding athletes to higher standards of character. Why are we doing that when we can't even hold our politicians to that? 815, at this point, what's in it for Pete Rose? Maybe it's just about legacy for him. I would assume there is financial implication. Maybe there's revenue sharing. I don't know. Maybe there's access to the union plan. I'm sure there's... He wouldn't be that interested in being reinstated if there weren't financial implications. Maybe he gets to play in the All-Star softball game if he's reinstated. Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame, period, irregardless of his personality or horrible haircut. He's already in. Now, the writers put him in the Hall of Fame. So he's in, but he's technically out because he's not been. So maybe that's what it is, right? Maybe that could be part of it. Isn't that the case that I thought the writers had said he's the guy. He should be in the Hall of Fame. And yet he can't be because he's not in baseball. I don't know how that works. 312-981-7200. Keep going through these. They're great. These are awesome. 630 said there should just be a corner in the hall, like a hall of shame in Cooperstown. We just have a bunch of these guys. They made it in, but they don't get their bus next to everybody else. They're in the other room. They're in the broom closet in the front. That's excellent. A little room off to the side. And these guys made it too. You got Barry Bonds, you got a Roger Clemens, you got a Pete Rose. There'll be some random in there. Wally Joyner. Well, Wally Joyner, what do you do? Oh, sorry, you're just not supposed to be in here. Supposed to be in a different. All right, we'll wrap. Get some calls that are coming in here. You know what I'll do? I'll take a break. And if we got some more stuff, we'll talk about it. But I do want to get to these 50 signature drinks, the study that came out today. Very interesting because there's so many great drinks that are representing different states. And then you get to the state of Illinois and it's Malort. Are we serious? Are we going to let this fly? What is the signature drink? I don't know. I would think the signature drink here would be, I don't know, an old fashioned? What is this? I don't even know what a signature drink would be, but it's not Malort. Talk about that coming up here. 720 WGN. Stay with us. Story in the Tribune today, and I think it's actually from another place. They're doing one of those shares where they have a bunch of... I don't even know what the name of this place is, but it's all about the state's signature drink. They go through all 50 states, and they kind of tongue-in-cheek go through a signature drink for all of them. It's called Shaken and Stirred. I read the piece, and it's really a slideshow. But it's this is what they say. A state's signature drink can mean many things. Maybe the recipe was first dreamed up at an iconic local institution. Maybe it's a menu item every beloved local sports bar is slinging on game day, or maybe the state grows an abundance of one of these key ingredients. A signature drink can be a spiked version of a local beverage favorite, or maybe the drink the locals just seem to love the most. Whatever the case, every state has a 21-plus favorite. Oh, cool. I love that. So then they go through it, and you're like, whiskey on the rocks for Alabama. You've got a tequila sunrise for Arizona. You've got California's red wine, Colorado, the tree line, Moscow Mule for Connecticut. Anyway, you keep going down the line. You got Hawaii's got the Mai Tai. They got an Idaho is like potato vodka. And they get to Illinois. And I'm like, what's it going to be? Do I drink it? No. The Illinois, they call it the Swedish seed. Well, I've never heard of that. Illinois' signature drink might not be everyone's favorite, but it can be considered a cult liquor in the Midwestern state. The bitter liqueur, Malort, was first introduced in the 1930s and produced by Chicago's Carl Jepsen Company until it was sold to CH Distillery in 2018. The Swedish Seed is a cocktail made of Malort, root liqueur, lemon juice, brown sugar, honey syrup, and bitters. And it turns the love-to-hate liquor into a cocktail. Bogus. I've never heard of that. Have you heard of that, Pete? No one's ever heard of that. You're making stuff up. I don't even know if you're... Maybe you're on the take in this article. I don't know what's... like. Maybe you work for Jepsen's Malort. Malort is... Are you even familiar with what Malort is? I'm new to Malort. I've only known it for the last 10 years. I had a taste test somewhere where we did it, and I tasted it, and it's when it's just the liquor, it's gross. It's like a very, it's like what I consider maybe linoleum to taste like. It's really not great. And it's got a Chicago thing because it's made here, but most of it comes from hipster culture where they're like, Malort's so funny. It's so funny. It tastes so bad. That's really the irony. It's so ironic. We love terrible liquor. And so for this article to suggest that the Illinois signature drink is Malort is bogus. I don't buy it. Nobody buys that, right? 815 says, 630, sorry, it says Old Style. Yeah, I agree. That's a beer. And this is about cocktails, signature drinks. But maybe there's some stuff. 815 says Slow Gin, Southern Comfort, and Vodka plus some OJ. Yeah, there you go. 815 says, I used to drink Malort. I had a drunk come up to me one time at a bar years ago and say, Malort tastes like the inside of a prosthetic leg. Says, I don't drink it anymore. That's almost perfect. That is so perfect. Oh. 312-981-7200. That's great. I don't think... I want to do a write-in petition. I don't want this to stand as the signature drink for the state of Illinois. It can't. Nobody drinks that. Nobody. Not even five people. So what's the signature drink then? What's the cocktail that you go to? What's the go-to Illinois signature drink that should replace Malort or the Swedish Seed in this bogus study that's in the Tribune or survey or whatever it is? The Daily Meal. Bob, what do you think? I'm right. I'm right about Malort, right? This is ridiculous. Bob?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's all right.
I didn't know. No, Malort, blue-collar bars back in the 80s. Somebody, you'd say, hey, man, you got to try this. And they pull a dusty bottle out, oh, my God.
Yeah, right.
And you drink it, paint thinner. I've never drank paint thinner, but that's about as close, and you never drink it again.
It's weird. You're absolutely right. It's a paint thinner vibe, and you never drink it again. You're like, that's
no,
it.
No.
You feel
good.
Some
people, it's become hot to drink up on the north side here in Andersonville, from what I heard, because that's where it's from, Sweden. It's like Swedish moonshine. And I always tell people, you got to be kidding me. You're drinking that stuff? And I always tell people about it, and a lot of people have still never heard of it. You know,
well, that's
and
what I'm they're like, saying. Oh, man. Yeah, that's
you
got to
drink
saying.
It once in your life. Once in your life, if you're a drinker, you do a shot. Tell them not to overfill it, and you just, you know, you get this weird expression on your face and say, "Okay, now I've been initiated, and I'll never have it again."
I know that. Thanks, Bob. That's exactly. I know that feeling. Maybe the Swedish Seed works. Maybe, you know, if you try it the way they set it up here, and they set it up with a very specific type of drink, and I'm not sure I would ever know to do this. A cocktail made with Malort, root liqueur, lemon juice, brown sugar, honey syrup, and bitters. I guess I get the brown sugar part. It turns this love-to-hate liquor into a cocktail. It doesn't say a good cocktail. Still seems like it'd be tough to... literally tough to swallow. 608 says water. The signature drink for Chicago is Mad Dog. It's a beer, but that's all right. Everyone I know, this is what I was looking for. 708 says, everyone I know drinks beer or they drink Jack and Coke. That's a go-to, right? That I would assume, I would probably, if this study or research, whatever it is, survey came out and they said the signature drink for Illinois is Jack and Coke, I'd go, that makes sense, right? That totally makes sense. 773 says, it tastes like rotten dandelions strained through dirty gym socks, but I'll defend it and drink it shot by shot. Oh, wow, that's great. 412 says, do they still make Mad Dog? I'm not sure they do. Was it Mad Dog 2020? I think the choice in Illinois should be Jack and Coke. I agree. Whatever our choice in Illinois, it better be a real drink for real men, or out you go through the door, out the window. Well, what would that be? Like not a like a hurricane? Well, I don't even know what a manly drink is these days. Like a pisco sour. I was ordering. Can I get a pisco sour? They're good. Anything with egg whites? I'll take anything with egg whites. All right. Linda says she's done her own research. Linda, okay, so you're on the case. You agree Malort is not the signature drink.
Oh, heavens no.
Yeah, right. So what is?
I called Six Bars, Hooters, TGI Fridays, and the consensus is Long Island iced tea.
Nice. You did the research. I love it.
I did. And second is vodka cranberry.
Oh, there you go. Fantat, Linda, we need you as a statistician on this program. You can be our go-to, well, right? Good job.
Well, I figured I'd ask the people that know.
And do they automatically know it or to think about it?
No, they automatically knew.
Wow, it's interesting. Long Island iced tea. All right, I'll buy it. Thanks, Linda. Awesome job. All right, how about it? Long Island iced tea, calling up different bars in the area. Vodka cranberry seems about right. I'm not much of a drinker, be honest with you. The cocktails, I find myself when I'll go out before dinner or maybe even at dinner, and we'll probably tend to lean towards cocktails because the cocktail bar menu comes out. And I rarely ever admit this to my wife, but I don't recognize any of the liquor. I just kind of sit there like, You read the 9 things they have on the menu, and you're like, yeah. And then they come around, and you're like, and she'll go, I'll have this. And I go, you know what, let's make it 2. Let's go ahead. Because by the time you get, it's not going to, there's a great bar that I go to, it's called The Darling, which I really do like it. It's kind of a speakeasy thing in the West Loop. It's you kind of behind a door, it's a whole thing, and they have performers that come out every 15 minutes and do like kind of vaudeville. It's really great. It's a great spot. Anyway, we go there, and every time we go there, I'm like, look at this. This cocktail bar, so it's like everything's like $17 or something like that. But you're like, And I can't even tell because they do it by, it drives me crazy. Like, you'd think that they would just give you the name of the liquor. You know, it's Pete Zimmerman vodka, but it's just Pete Zimmerman. So you're like, I don't know what that is. And so you don't want to ask the waiter. You don't look like an idiot. So you're just like, And my wife will be like, ooh, I'll have the Fantastic Ladyland. And I'll be like, you know, that sounds good. I'll get 2 of those. Because at the end of the day, it all tastes the same. All right. So Long Island iced tea is the vibe right now, I guess. You want Malort for free? Drink out of a recently used toilet. Oh, come on, Mike. You're right. I didn't say you're wrong. Come on. Bloody Mary's 217 says, I'm into that. I would take that, right? A Bloody Mary? What is in iced tea? That's a question. Iced tea? What's in iced tea? In the Long Island iced tea? The Long Island iced tea is a mixture of like 9 liquors, isn't it? That's the weird thing about why that would be the signature drink. There is not a good experience for anyone who has decided that they are going to spend the night drinking Long Island iced teas. That is not that's a pathway to a bad spot. There is all sorts of stuff in it, right? Is it a whiskey-based drink? But it's the idea of a Long Island iced tea is there's four or five different liquors in it. I'm sure people know. Mad Dog is definitely still a thing, says 815. I just had a bottle of it at a college party a couple weeks ago. All right, there you go. I don't know. Any guy that's drinking a Long Island iced tea or cranberry anything sounds like millennial. It's beer, shots, and a mixed... I can't see what that... Yeah, with three or less ingredients. A mixed drink with three or less ingredients. That's the rule? Beer, shots, mix of three or less ingredients. I'll have a... let me get the vodka with the grenadine and vermouth and go ahead and sprinkle in some cinnamon and some eggs in it. That's not a manly drink. And do you have any tropical fruit that you could put in? That's what I feel like it always comes down to. 312-981-7200. Wow. 312's got a whole thing. Make your own. One pound of raisins in a clean container. Fill it with water 2 inches from the... What? Oh, this is for Long Island iced tea? Wow. But 773 calls it. You can't have an Illinois drink named after Long Island. Yeah, you can't do that. That's absolutely true. 815 says, how about just Everclear? That's such a dumb drink, right? 630 Goldschlager. That's the liquor with the gold flakes in it. And it takes me right back to Wrigleyville in college. That's where Goldschlager's at. 312-981-7200. We're talking about Illinois' signature drink. The Tribune had a piece up today about all 50 states and their signature drink, and Illinois was Malort. That's a head shaker. No way. Nobody drinks that stuff. They drink it once, as our listeners have told us, so they can have the experience. But that is not the signature drink. Linda called around already for it, which is awesome. She found out Long Island iced tea and cranberry or vodka cranberry are the two go-to drinks for the state of Illinois by calling TGI Fridays, Hooters, and something else. She may be right. Seems like that seems like a go-to. What's your thought on it? 312-981-7200. Stay with us. So many texts coming in about the Malort being the go-to signature drink for Chicago, in front of Chicago, for the state of Illinois. This is the story that is in the Tribune today, saying they picked 50 signature drinks for 50 states. So it's a lot of cocktails. It's mostly cocktails, because I had a couple texts that were just about old style, things like that. But when they got to Illinois, it was all about Malort. Malort is the famed, I don't even know what you call it, anti-cocktail. It's a liquor that is not very well, it's not received very well. It's not a great tasting liquor. As one caller said, it was like tasting paint thinner. It's just annoying because I feel like, you know, for those who may drink in the state of Illinois, it feels like a signature drink would be something you'd want to be proud of. And Malort is not it. I'm not on board with the hipster irony of a really bad tasting liquor. And that's awesome. That's so awesome. Malort's so awesome. Chicago. No. Ridiculous. And this said the state of Illinois. Outside of Chicago, I'm not sure Malort's playing in the Naperville bar right now. Down in Champaign, where they're like, you know what? Let me get some Malort. That's ridiculous. I don't like it. 312-981-7200. 847 is like one bourbon, one scotch, one beer. Sure. 773 comes through. I'm a bartender. Thank you, bartender, for being the authority here. I sell a ridiculous amount of bourbon and old fashions. Long Islands are made with all white liquors. Triple sec, sour, splash of Coke. Okay, there you go. But a ridiculous amount of bourbon and old fashions. That seems like the go-to. See, that makes sense to me. Who doesn't like an old fashioned, right? If you're a whiskey drinker or bourbon drinker. But it seems like that, if I would have come across Illinois and it said an old fashioned or bourbon straight up, I'd be like, yeah, that makes sense. That seems like a drink that is universal to the state of Illinois, not Malort. I'm surprised. It makes me mad because would think that the Chicago Tribune, because the way if you're going to make that relevant, you, I don't know if they're sharing because it's a daily meal, whatever that is. That's where the original thing came from. But you would think that the story would be, hey, they picked a drink. Do you think this is our drink? So they just kind of presented it. Here it is. This is clickbait. Nah, we don't care. I was kind of annoyed for all the great, you know, food writers they have and what have you. I would think that they would be like, no, I'm taking a stand. Don't put this on the website. Don't you dare put this on the website. Instead, there it is. And we're all clicking through going, huh, really? Old-fashioned makes a lot more sense. And keep going. So many conversations saying maybe the cocktail of choice is beer. Old style, Blatt's, Old Milwaukee. Old Milwaukee, though, automatically you can't. You're not talking about Milwaukee Avenue, right? You're talking about Old Milwaukee. I'm talking about Milwaukee. Don't give up on Jack and Coke. Pretty popular with the over 50 crowd. And no one over 50 goes to those millennial bars that your caller surveyed. Okay. Well, I would not say Hooters and TGI Friday is the millennial bar that you're talking about. That's hilarious. Serving. Good stuff. All right? Mary says, yeah, you got to go up to Ishinala for the old fashioned. That's right. So this is the recipe for Long Island iced tea. 1/2 ounce each of vodka, rum, gin, tequila, triple sec, 1 ounce of sweet and sour, and cola. Shake. Ugh. I don't know about that. That just seems like too much. Also, that's got to be so expensive, right? Doesn't the Long Island iced tea, you just mentioned like 4 or 5 different liquors. You're trying to make that at home? I don't know about that. 708 says, how about Captain Morgan and Coke? It's possible, too. I like that drink. I'll drink that. A spiced rum, but that's Jack and Coke, rum and Coke. But I agree with the bartender who gave us the inside information that the drinks, the ridiculous amount of old fashions and bourbons. So there you go. 312-981-7200. Coming up tomorrow night, Molly Melman's going to join us. Molly Melman is one of the Melman siblings, of course, daughter to Rich Melman and the Let Us Entertain You restaurant empire. Molly Melman is the unsung sibling of the group. So you may know RJ Melman runs the company. Jared's also big in the nightclubs. But behind the scenes is making it all work for all the restaurants that Let Us Entertain You has is Molly. I think she might be the youngest. Any which way, Molly Melman will be our guest tomorrow. We'll talk a little restaurants on Friday. Also, and we kind of talked about this a little bit earlier because Greg Kot's coming on with Bob Surratt tomorrow. This week, the city of Chicago named 2020 the year of Chicago music. They're going out of their way to highlight and showcase the music scene here in Chicago. The problem is 2 days later, the announcement was made that Greg Kot is taking a buyout at the Chicago Tribune. And if you're familiar, Greg Kot is the music critic, the premier music critic in town. DeRogatis is his, you know, sort of his at the movies partner from the Sun-Times, but they do Sound Opinions together on the show. But DeRogatis doesn't do as many rock features anymore. So it's pretty much Greg. And it used to be a slew of other papers. It used to have Chicagoist would do it. You had Red Eye. You had Sun-Times, other places. But as you look to the landscape in 2020, if Greg Kot is not replaced, which taking a buyout that usually is what that means, you're going to be without a major critic in the city of Chicago for music, which would be the first time in decades. And what does that mean? Love to talk to the city of Chicago now when they're like, this is the year of Chicago music, but no one's going to write about it. That's essentially where we're at. That's crazy. Let's talk about that. And I'm not sure if that's the future, if arts in general, newspapers and other places are going to go the way of, hey, you know what, we can get freelancers or we're just not going to talk about it at all, figure it out on your own. And will we see less arts and culture coverage in the major newspapers? As the, it wasn't just Greg, there were others too. Carmel, who's the longtime entertainment editor, the entertainment section at the Tribune, which used to be a pretty thick section, she took the buyout as well. As long as a lot of great reporters did. It's unfortunate to see a lot of names on there that are getting out of the business this week. So we'll talk about that coming up tomorrow on the program. All right, Nick DiGilio coming up next here on 720 WGN. Stay with us.